Rob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Minute past the hour, and we begin this prayer meeting Wednesday on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if you want to pop into the chat room, where the beginnings of a nice crowd. I'm sorry, it's Wednesday. Congregation are filing in. Good evening, 4 of 9. Good evening, Jeremy. Good evening, Jug of Punch. Good evening, Waggy. All capably moderated by inveterate, veteran, indefatigable chat room moderator Sparky, who is actually man caved this evening because he's a third stage guild navigator and has, in fact, folded space out to the man cave. Thank you, Jeremy in Vermont. Loud and clear on TuneIn, Bob, Jeremy says. That's an important notification because we don't really have any way of monitoring direct air back here. So it's good to know. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy. Yep, it's Prayer Meeting Wednesday on the Horn this year, 29th day of April, 2015. Rousing good conversations last night. Thank you for all the kind words. And I think this being Prayer Meeting Wednesday, we're going to have another rousing good conversation this evening in a matter of minutes. Yes, indeed, more on that in a second. Little program note, remember, no program Friday, as it is 22nd anniversary night for Agnes and me. We're gonna get a loaf of Wonder Bread and maybe make up some bologna sandwiches and a little mustard and maybe some mayonnaise if we're feeling real ritzy. And, I don't know, hike out along the trail somewhere and just sit down and have a little anniversary dinner out there in the wilds of almost level West Bicol, Virginia. Yep. Of course, a gentle reminder, this program, this network, and that includes Dr. Bill as well and running Rick Smith too, this network is entirely listener-supported. And we try to raise $150 every evening. If you would like to be a part of that, you are most welcome to be, because there are beginning-of-the-month bills, middle-of-the-month bills, and end-of-the-month bills. Sometimes beginning-of-the-month bills get put off till the end of the month, depending on how things are running. And, well, there's stuff needs paying all the time. So if you would care to kick in, have a show on me is $150. And what else? Well, anything. $5, $10, $15, $20, you name it. It all is a tremendous, tremendous help in keeping the Horn on the air. No ads here. Hell, no breaks. You know, we joke about the filibobster, but really, with the exception of stopping on Tuesdays and Thursdays to run the Green News Report, and the occasional musical interlude, this program starts at 6 Eastern Time and does not stop until 9. And so, where else does that? I know. So if you would like to go to the Contribute tab at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com and kick in to help, it is most welcome and most necessary and is, in fact, the only blessed thing. We'll use that word, this being Wednesday and everything, the only blessed thing that keeps us going. And it is your determination over the years that has turned this from a little fledgling effort into a 10-year-long conversation. And for that, everyone who is involved in the Horn Family Commune congregation, thanks you. And a gentle reminder, when you do kick in, remember, everybody, we don't sell subscriptions here. We don't have anything to give you. We don't sell anything. Your contributions are gifts that keep this non-commercial enterprise, this non-commercial non-enterprise, going. And when you contribute, remember, you are contributing for a whole bunch of people who either can't or don't. So bear that in mind, please. The PayPal interface is at headonradionetwork.com behind the tab that's called Contribute. I realize there are some pushy little questions there, but ignore those and just fill in enough information to get to the next screen where you make your PayPal, credit card choices, what have you. Okay? Thank you. And, of course, if you choose to prefer to participate via the U.S. Postal Service, well, we have a mailbox. Checks and money orders made payable to The Horn should be sent to The Horn, see how it works, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. And if you want to give me a heads up when you do that, then I can let Boss Man Wayne know, and he, in turn, will not have to put on the spider-proof gloves when he reaches into the echo chamber that is more often than not the mailbox. Spider's about chewed the gloves off his hands last time he reached in. Yeah. So this here being prayer meeting Wednesday, we're going to forego the usual opening shtick. I know you guys love it, but we're going to forego that because we have a guest coming here in the next couple of minutes or so, and you might as well think of him as a guest pastor, or maybe we're having a revival here at the Cathedral of Common Sense. See, I almost did it this evening. Frank Schaefer will be joining us momentarily. Frank Schaefer was there at the birth of the evangelical movement that co-opted the Republican Party and became known later on as the religious right in the United States of America, and it continues to plague us to this day. Mm-hmm. He is a respected author. He is a producer and director of film. And he spends a lot of his time trying to create a bridge between believers and non-believers, as well as opening up a dialogue into understanding, as it were, how we got in this handbasket and where it is we're going in it. So he'll be with us in a matter of a couple of minutes. Agnes is standing by on the gizmo phone waiting to take his call. And I hope you will enjoy the conversation as much as do I. That having been said, by way of a little bit of an introduction, Mr. Schaefer is most recently the author of Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How Just a minute. Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Create Beauty, Give Love, and Find Peace. And he has had quite a journey to get to where he is. In recent years, he has also been the author of Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Live to Take All or Almost All of It Back. And provides a critical understanding of where the right-wing religion movement came from, the Christian religion movement, and where it hopes to take us. With that having been said, let me welcome to the horn, with thanks for taking time to join us in conversation, Frank Schaefer. Frank, good evening. Again, thank you for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. Where, by the way, where are you located?
I am in the hills and hollers of almost level west by Cole, Virginia.
Hey, sounds good. I'm up in Massachusetts, right on the New Hampshire border. So, you know, different parts of the country, but here we are.
Absolutely. Through the miracle of the modern internet and cell phone telecommunications. And
the whole bit.
Yes, indeed. It is a real pleasure to have you on the program. I've been reading about you since Crazy for God came out back in 2007. And I'm absolutely tickled to talk to you this evening regarding not just that, but as well why I'm an atheist who believes in God, which I must admit, Frank, is more than a little bit of a curious title to me. I thought those things were mutually exclusive. Maybe we'll find out otherwise by the time we're done.
Right.
But also, if you don't mind, you occupy a very, very unique position as a witness to history relative to the, and I don't know of many other terms to use but this, the coup that took place by which the evangelical religion industry, for lack
right.
of a better term, took over the Republican Party. So
witness to history is right because, of course, okay, I'm 62 years old. I have three grown kids and five grandchildren. I'm at that part of your life where you look back with a little bit of contemplative thought about your past. And, of course, that's where these memoirs have come out of, like Crazy for God and now this book, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And the subtitle of that book is instructive because it's How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. And obviously, that's the exact opposite of what the religious right has been doing. And they have been giving hate, they have created ugliness, and they have created a climate of mutual distrust and hatred between all the political factions in this country. And they've done it because they've taken the kind of absolutist, fundamentalist Christianity that I was raised with as the son of a missionary evangelist, and tried to politicize it and turn it into a movement. And I know this is kind of out of order, but I mean, here's kind of a basic fact that I think we can talk about a little bit. You know, back in the day in the 1970s and 80s, when I was my father Francis Schaefer's sidekick in the religious right, flying around this country in Jerry Falwell's borrowed jet, talking at places like the Southern Baptist Convention, et cetera, et cetera. We would talk to people like Gerald Ford and George Bush and Ronald Reagan and Jack Kemp, who became a personal friend of mine, who were politicians, as kind of agitators, outsiders, knocking on the door of power, trying to get them to do things we wanted, like make abortion illegal or whatever it might be. But they were ordinary politicians, so you could disagree with the politics of Ronald Reagan or a Jack Kemp, but they were not fundamentalist Christians with a theocratic agenda trying to turn America into a theocracy. Maybe we were those people, but we were outsiders, we were agitators, and they played our game so they could get evangelical votes. But if you fast forward to today, coming to 2016, if you look at people like Ted Cruz and this whole gang, they are who I used to be in the 70s and 80s. The only difference is they're actually running Congress. So coup is the right word. See, there's one thing to have extremists agitating for their policies. It's another thing when the extremists actually take over an entire political party and dominate the American discourse. And that's where we are today. So I've lived long enough, although I've been out of that evangelical world for close to 30 years now, but I have lived long enough to see something change, and that is the outside agitators actually became the insiders, and that's where we are today. So there's been a real sea change in American politics, and one of the things I do in Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God is I talk about the fact that my own sense of spirituality that has moved away from the evangelical right has really tried to re-embrace an idea of inclusive spirituality, progressive spirituality, that really predates this religious right takeover. So there's actually been two coups, and then I'll be quiet because I know you have a lot of questions, but there's really been two coups. The first coup is that the religious right has taken over the levers of power within the Republican Party, and they've come into an unholy alliance with the Koch brothers and others who have a whole different economic agenda. But all of a sudden now the religious right are doing things like questioning climate change and all the rest as if this is part of their agenda. Whereas back in my day it was all about abortion, but it wasn't about denying climate change and all the right-wing stuff that's come with the oil industry and the rest of it. But the second coup has been that this political religious right has actually taken over the image of Christianity in America. So if you say you're a Christian today, nobody's thinking of Martin Luther King anymore. Nobody's thinking about the people who fought for the emancipation of slaves. Nobody's thinking about the people who founded some of the institutions that we revere in this country, and did so because they believed in a type of Christianity that was essentially a form of humanism and education and these other things. Now we think of people like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, or Ted Cruz, or Sarah Palin, or all these other guys. So that the second coup has been the ruination of the image of Christianity. Now, that should concern people who consider themselves Christians, and it may not bother atheists and people on the outside of the movement, but really, for someone who comes from a Christian background like I do, it's very distressing, as it were, to see the old neighborhood taken over by thugs, as well as the country's predominant political party now running both houses of Congress, taken over by people who are very much like we used to be, except now they're on the inside. And with that long preamble as a kind of an introduction to where I come from, you know, I'll be happy to take questions.
Well, and I have you were correct. You were almost prophetic. I have a million of them, Frank.
Yeah.
Because just so that we can be on level ground in terms of our conversation.
Sure.
I am what I describe to our friends out here in the Horn community. I'm a recovering Southern Baptist.
Right, right.
And I was dipped by the heel in this stuff from the time that I was born. I'm about 11 years younger than you.
Right.
But I grew up my late childhood and early adolescence were marked by the rise of the religious right and a dramatic shift in, if not tone, then intent inside
right.
that Southern Baptist Church in Alabama where I grew up.
Right.
I started out, as many of us did, with the little old blue-haired ladies down in the basement who were singing, teaching us to sing Jesus Loves the Little Children.
Yeah.
And by the time I got upstairs, I was listening to a preacher who was, for all intents and purposes, a surrogate for Jerry Falwell.
Correct. Yep.
And the two don't mix, Frank.
No, they do not. So just so we, speaking of level playing fields, give me a thumbnail of kind of where you'd be today, and I'll be glad to reciprocate. So where's your head at right now, my brother?
I will tell you candidly that I'm one of those people that will not be associated with the name Christian for so long as it is a wholly owned subsidiary of a group of, and I think you use the right word, political thugs.
Yes.
Who have corrupted the message of Jesus Christ.
Right.
Who have selectively edited the words of Paul. You know, there's a lot of issues with Paul. There's misogyny rolling around out there. And I as a consequence, in going to college, Frank, I did the hard work. Because
right.
I grew up with that study to show thyself approved mentality that was almost, you know, served at supper.
Yeah,
When I was a child, my mother and I would sit on Saturday night, I with my Sunday school book on my lap and she with hers, and she'd have a stack of six different translations of the Bible trying to suss out the meaning of the morning's lesson next day.
Right, right.
And so when I got to college, I actually engaged in some scholarship. And I came to a conclusion that, and in later conversations, say on this network, say with the noted scholar Bart Ehrman, I came to an understanding that either somebody was deliberately lying to me, or it was a matter of the ignorant leading the more ignorant.
Right, right, which I think the latter is often the case. You know, we share a lot because, of course, I grew up, you know, weirdly, to say we share a lot. I was in Switzerland, but I was in a fundamentalist mission called Le Brie Fellowship, started by my father and mother, Francis Nita Schaefer, back in the 1950s.
Oh, yours is a name that is known to me.
Right. No, I would imagine so, because, you know, probably back in the day when you had your Jerry Falwell clone up there in the pulpit, I'll bet he had a couple of my dad's books on his shelf to give a little intellectual respectability, at least as he thought, to, you know, what he believed. But the irony here is that my father, before he became associated with the religious right because of the abortion issue, you know, if you had visited the community of Le Brie where I grew up, say, in 1968, when it was a stop for backpacking, hitchhikers, hippies, other people traveling around Europe who got a free place to stay and then would stick around this commune run by evangelical Christians, but it was much more free and open. And so what's odd is that the kind of Christianity I actually grew up with was very much being denied by the religious right movement that my dad and I got in bed with, me as his young sidekick in my early 20s, him as someone in his mid-50s, as we headed into this the abortion debate, which then became the kind of nexus around which the entire movement was built and changed and became so radically politicized. But, you know, oddly enough, as I talk about in this book of mine, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, there was a lot of conflict in me even then, because so much of the commercialism on one hand and then this really ugly politicizing of Christianity on the other wasn't just a question of being uncomfortable with that because I was opening my eyes. It actually denied the kind of simple, basic Christianity that my parents preached back in the day and the open home they kept for people who came, including gay people and others who they would have disagreed with theologically but were very welcoming to. So, you know, one of the first things that happened to me is that the kind of people we were hanging around with, Pat Robertson, James Dobson of Focus on the Family, Jerry Falwell, these other guys, and right-wing movers and shakers in the Republican Party, actually would not have fit into my parents' earlier ministry in the sense that, and I know you'll hear what I'm saying here given your background, you know, the worst that could be said about the kind of Christians I knew back in the day before this all went south, you know, they thought you'd go to hell and burn if you didn't accept Jesus, but they didn't care how you voted. They weren't all about trying to turn the country into a theocracy.
Absolutely.
They just wanted you to accept Jesus as your savior. Now, that might be crazy. That may be a crock. But that was just their thing. It wasn't beating you over the head because you don't have an anti-Obama bumper sticker on your car.
No, there used to be, if you could count on any religious sect in the United States to honor and, in fact, be out there building buttresses on the wall between separation
right.
between church and state. It was the Southern Baptist Convention.
You got it. That whole separation of church and state thing came out of that convention. They didn't want to be messed with.
Yeah. You do your politics, and we'll have our doctrine and our dogma over here. And by the way, do you know Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior?
Yeah, and you know, back in the day when my dad and I, back in the mid-70s to late-70s, went out on the circuit with Whatever Happened to the Human Race, which was our anti-abortion film series and book that went with it, made with Sierra Coop, who then became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General. You know, one of the big fights we had, actually, was with Southern Baptist leaders who were saying, this isn't our issue. Why are you talking about this? We're all about Jesus. Why is this suddenly about abortion and women and what they should do or not do? This isn't our issue. So what's interesting is Dr. Criswell, whose name you may know, was a big Southern Baptist pastor in Dallas, the Southern Baptist pastor in Dallas, the first Baptist of Dallas, and also the president of Dallas Theological Seminary.
About as close to a Vatican as Southern Baptists are going to get.
You got it. Well, he sat down and virtually had a shouting match with my dad over the fact that he not only was pro-choice, and this will blow some of your listeners' minds, I mean, this is Mr. Southern Baptist, but thought it would be terribly destructive to make this an issue. And he said, but it's going to take away from our ability to evangelize. So that's how those guys saw it. And then, you know, they had to get their arms twisted and eventually signed on. Same, by the way, with the editorial staff of Christianity Today magazine. I mean, the central publication of the Billy Graham folks that Carl Henry started with Billy Graham and that became the kind of flagship of evangelicalism. Back in those days, the editor was pro-choice when Roe v. Wade came down. In addition to which, by the way, he was writing editorials taking us to task for making this an issue. So that's, you know, I don't think folks on the outside of the evangelical machine, and certainly people of a younger age, don't understand that, as you know, as I said a moment ago, you said there was a coup. There were two coups. One is the takeover of the Republican Party by the folks who then become the Tea Party and everybody we know now. But the other is the actual coup within evangelicalism itself, which changed it from a religious movement, which you could take or leave, but hey, it was a religious movement, to a political and a radicalized political force. And that, I think, is something that's not a story that gets told as much.
And I think, Frank, that maybe the best way for us to go about this is to start micro and maybe go macro.
Sure.
By that, I mean, if you don't mind, would you explain, and then let me just throw a couple of questions out there and then let
sure.
you come to them as it makes sense to you. One, what was your epiphany that led you to walk away from what had been so much of the foundation of your life?
Right.
Two.
Well, let me start with that one.
Okay.
And then hold the other ones, and I'll try to keep some of these answers a little shorter. Although, as you know, this is such a complex kind of big issue.
Well, it is, and as long as you're willing to explain, I and the Horn audience are willing to listen.
Hey, I'll give my best shot. There wasn't an epiphany, but I'll tell you what the steps were. You know, in this kind of evangelical hippie commune called Liberty Fellowship where I grew up, I was surrounded by, you know, artists, backpackers, university students. They'd come to talk with my dad, who was a theologian and philosopher who was interested in art, and we had arts festivals, and it was a very cool place. And yes, it was Christian and it was evangelical, but it was not in any way exclusionary or mean-spirited. Dad, through a series of circumstances, becomes this big religious right leader because of his quote-unquote stand on abortion made through a film series that I had produced and directed called How Should We Then Live? And then Whatever Happened to the Human Race, a second series. So then all of a sudden in the nepotistic tradition of evangelicalism, which is, by the way, just like Hollywood, I mean, you know, Mike Douglas and Kirk Douglas and Francis Schaeffer and Frank Schaeffer and Billy Graham and Franklin Graham and on and on and on, it's the form. You know, all of a sudden I'm out there as a speaker on the hustings with him. Okay, a couple of things. First of all, the religious right we were in bed with was completely out of step with the basic Christianity that I had grown up with, which was compassionate and open, loving and caring. Now, I was lucky that that's the kind of home I was in, but just start there. Now, I've walked away from evangelicalism per se, but I was still an evangelical then, but I could already see this is something different. You know, I'll give you one anecdote. I sat down with Jerry Falwell before I spoke from his pulpit, which I talked at his church twice and once to his old college student assembly. And we were talking about some gay protesters who had been out picketing the school because of some of his statements. And he looked at me completely seriously and he said, if I had a dog that did what they do, what those guys do, I'd shoot it. And he was serious. And I sort of just even compared that to my father's compassion to people when they came to LaPree. Didn't matter who they were or what they were doing. I mean, my dad was not that kind of a person. And it dawned on me that the kind of neo-fascist movement that we had stumbled into was nothing to do with the basic Christianity I'd been raised with. So that's point one. Point two, the kind of things I was interested in life, which is art and which is film and which is music and the kind of people I liked, were exactly the things that this movement I stumbled into hated. And so I began to feel very much like a fish out of water. And eventually, you know, woke up to the fact that I had inherited this kind of mantle from my father, but was believing less and less, theologically beginning to question things, no longer accepting a literal interpretation of the Bible, politically realizing that, you know, if these guys won and they knew what I really thought about just art, say, you know, I'd be put up against the wall with everybody else and shot. I mean, I just realized I was on the wrong side. And the kind of people I liked were our enemies. And so, you know, once you begin to ask those kind of questions, really things unravel. And the way they unraveled for me is the more successful I was getting, because I was speaking to bigger and bigger audiences. You know, I was the keynote speaker at the Religious Broadcasters one year, and shared the platform with Jerry Falwell and Dr. Dobson and all these guys. Ronald Reagan showed up, you know, to give a speech and so on. You know, this was big-time Christianity. The more I felt that I was getting embroiled in this, the more I began to kind of really question and hate myself and the life I was leading, which then almost destroyed my marriage and my family. I would come home off the road. I was spending 6 months on the road speaking on the circuit, and I would come home so pissed off, so consistently angry, that I was, you know, turning into a real jerk. I mean, I'm already kind of a jerk, but I mean, I was going to be a permanent jerk, two-faced, hating what I was doing, liking the money I was making and the access to power. And eventually I just figured, hey, you know, the fastest way to completely lose your faith is to become an evangelical leader in this context. And everything I really care about is going down the drain here. And so, you know, really overnight, I called the guy who was my producer that ran Schaefer Productions, and we had made these two multi-million-dollar film series and put together these huge events across the country to pitch How Should We Then Live and Whatever Happened to Human Race. And I said, I'm done. I'm walking away. And he said, well, what do we do with all the donations coming in? And I said, well, you're just going to have to put return sender on all of them and disperse whatever funds we have in the bank to some other nonprofit organization, because I'm finished. And I literally walked away, and that was the end of it. And, you know, I tell this story in Crazy for God, my memoir, and of course, you know, financially it was a disaster in every other way, but I was so lucky because I was still young enough and fortunately actually had an ability as a writer, so that when I started writing some secular novels like Portofino and Saving Grandma and Zermatt and these other books that were quite successful, I got some decent critical reviews, and I had a whole new audience that had never heard of the Schaefer name in terms of the evangelical ghetto. And while I've never earned as much money as I earned in my 20s, literally, during my whole life, because the big bucks were in the God business.
Well, that's why I call it a religion industry.
Yeah, I was in the religion industry, and I was at the heart of it, and I was very good at it. And so, you know, from that point of view, it was a dreadful error. But from the point of view of everything that makes human life worth living, like having children who are your friends and a wife who still loves you and some peace at night so you can sleep, you know, thank God, literally no irony intended. It was the best thing that ever happened to me, was walking away from the God business.
And at the same time, you didn't walk away from what, and the closest I can come, Frank, is to use the word spirituality. Okay, so
no,
that...
No, and you know, and in this book, Why I'm an Atheist, Reason God, you were commenting on the title, and really what the title is an anti-labeling title and a pro-paradox title. You know, back in the evangelical day, if you weren't steadfastly believing and you had any questions, then you were somehow slipping away from the faith. You know, I live in a dualistic kind of world. I mean, I believe, not only believe in evolution, but I believe brain chemistry explains personality. I'm essentially, you know, I can read E.O. Wilson's books and believe what he's saying. I mean, to the extent that a layman can understand the science. On the other hand, I feel a current of spiritual vitality in my life. It's sort of like, as I put it in the book, the offstage chorus in an opera, and I sense that. Now, is that just my imagination? Is this the way I was conditioned? These things I have no answer for, but instead of trying to resolve the question, the reason I put these two contradictory terms, why I'm an atheist who believes in God, in the same title, is I have become anti-labeling. So I look at spirituality just the way I say look at a word like love. And so let's just take the word love for a second. You know, some days when my wife and I have been fighting and then somebody leaves and slams the door, love means that evening, if you get back together, you hate the person that you live with a little less than you did in the morning when you were fighting. And other times love is golden and romantic and beautiful and sexual. But, you know, that word covers both. So I feel the same thing about words like spirituality and faith. Sometimes spirituality and faith just simply means you're a little less bitter and angry and unhappy at the way you were raised than you would be otherwise. And other times you embrace things that you believe and they feel real for a little while. But, you know, to try to decide means that you don't accept a basic idea that I believe is true, and that is that the actual human condition is paradoxical. And the way I put it in the book is like this. I just say, hey, listen, we are biological animals, biological machines, but we look at the world through spiritual eyes, deal with it. And there's no way to reconcile those two things. You can go into neurology and neuroscience and neuropsychology and try to come up with a formula, or you can become a religious fanatic and try to come up with a formula. Neither of these formulas really describe where most human beings live, no matter what we call ourselves. And so when I say spiritualized, that applies equally to atheists, because they love art. They have feelings of wonderful serendipitous events in their life that they give thanks for. This has nothing to do with religion. It's just an acknowledgement that we are spiritual beings, however you want to define that, and yet, nevertheless, we inhabit these completely biological, mechanical bodies. And instead of trying to resolve that with a faith statement or a science statement, I am willing to accept the paradox, and that's what my book is about. It's about finding peace and giving love and creating beauty within life by accepting this paradox and working on it within this acceptance, rather than trying to resolve it the way I would have in my fundamentalist days, when I would have said, oh, wow, you got to trust Jesus and get rid of your doubt or whatever it may be. So that's where I've sort of changed and come to over this course of my journey.
That's fascinating to me, because at the same time that I was getting educated on the synoptic gospels and the stuff that really led me to question what I had been taught in the Baptist church when I was in
right.
college, I was taking a class in Eastern philosophy, and I remember in the Zen portion of that intro survey class, some Zen master saying that the surest, straightest, quickest road to madness was to try to answer questions of the heart with the faculties of the mind.
Right. Here.
And that sounds exactly, and the minute that I heard that, you know, there were, I don't know, angelic choruses and fireworks, and it sounds a lot like what you just described.
Yeah, and I think our mistake that we make, and I also talk about this a little bit in the book, is that I think we put issues of spirituality in a special category, as if somehow, you know, we're going to get an answer and hear voices, rather than treating it as an ordinary part of life. And actually, if you look at the way real life is lived, relationships, our work, our vocations, there's never this straight path where we answer the questions. I mean, you know, I already used the example of love, but just going a little further down that path, when you look at a relationship with a family member or a child or a lover or somebody you're with and so on, there is not a way to categorically define that and say, well, you know, because I love my wife, I never look at other women, or because we were in love when we were kids, you know, this is the way we still have a relationship today. Or take fatherhood. You know, I got Jeannie pregnant when we were 17 and 18 in this fundamentalist ministry, by the way, which was an interesting experience. And actually, my parents were wonderful about that, but that's a different story. But that said, you know, when I look back at the quality of my fatherhood as a teen parent, you know, harsh, fundamentalist Christian, sure that I was right, head of the home, boss my wife around, discipline my kids. You know, I'd like to go back and just sit that guy down and say, hey, you know, you are a complete idiot. You're going to spend a lifetime regretting this. And I look at the way I relate to my five grandchildren these days, three of whom, by the way, that Jeannie and I care for every day, Nora, who's 1 year old, Jack, who's four, Lucy, who's six. Well, you know, I just spent the afternoon with Lucy after I picked her up from first grade today, and when I think about the quality of that relationship that's not founded on discipline or bossing her around or trying to raise her to believe certain things and just the openness and beauty of it, you know, that also is a relationship with a child, and I'm the same guy, and that's just one lifetime's learning curve. So when you get into these huge issues of cosmology and everything else, to think that in the lifespan of, say, 60 years of conscious thinking about this stuff, one human being can make some vast cosmological statement that's going to cover the facts, whether that's Christopher Hitchens or Dawkins or Sam Harris or Francis Schaeffer or Billy Graham, it's just nonsense. We are half-evolved, vicious little primates running around on this planet that we're wrecking. We don't know crap. And we are doing the best we can in individual lives to have our own personal learning curves. But those learning curves become nonsense when they eliminate paradoxical questioning, which is the only intelligent way to look at our world, because our whole survival skills of seeing patterns, colors, all these other things, half the stuff we observe doesn't even exist. I mean, just take one issue. There are no colors. that color only exists in your own brain as you translate light rays reflected back through your retinal machinery into a brain that's trying to make a pattern out of it. You know, we live in this sort of odd sphere of information that comes to us half-baked that we then, our brain turns into something. So what I call for in the book a little bit is just some basic humility, at least when we look at where we are on our own evolutionary path, if nothing else. We've just developed consciousness. We stood up 2 minutes ago. 10 seconds ago, we became conscious. 5 seconds ago, we developed empathy. Okay, that's where we're actually at as human beings. And so rather than concentrate on these huge issues as if somehow we're going to resolve them, I know this sounds like pablum, but how about develop a good relationship with your granddaughter? How about take a look at the way you relate to your wife or your lover? How about we look at how we relate to the other, quotation marks, and think about how we receive people who are very different from ourselves and try to actually make this little corner work slightly better? So I kind of urge people to get off their high wagon here, you know, the high hog, and really look, break it down into bite-sized pieces that really mirror where we all actually live. And where we all actually live is not providing answers to the meaning of life. Where we live is trying to find intrinsic beauty and meaning in our individual lives by the way we relate to people around us. And so I don't think the best mirror of human existence is a book, whether it's the Bible or a religion or a teaching. You know,
no, it's a book is nothing more than a reflection of
right.
A reflection of the collected wisdom of a given, especially holy books, of a given
right.
people at a given time.
That's
why I frequently suggest that relative to the religious right, and I'll be honest with you, Frank, when I talk about them, I refer to them as evangelicals.
Right, evangelicals, yeah.
And you know, I have to ask the question, why are these people running around here trying to make a 21st century of the common era culture adhere to and take their cues from Bronze Age people who didn't understand why it rained and were baffled by wheelbarrows?
Right, exactly. Well, essentially, I mean, the short answer is, I think if you could do a neurological study of Ted Cruz's brain, what you would find is the same things lighting up on the screen as you would with a drug addict. And the reason for that is that we are living in a time when the religious right is really a group of people who are, and this is the way I would put it, certainty addicts. They are addicted to the need for certainty. And so they accept simplistic and often false solutions to complex problems, and cannot have any wiggle room because they are literally addicted. They have an addictive personality to certainty. And so the very idea of questioning, the very idea of looking at things more in a more open way, whether it's homosexuality or, you know, or climate change or relationships of men and women or, you know.
Yeah, they're absolute absolutists.
Yeah, it drives them crazy because their brain, you know, one thing, you know, back in the day when I was younger, most of the discussion about how the human brain worked was on a psychology basis. As, you know, like you feel a certain way and so forth. Now, of course, what we understand is that not only is brain chemistry real, but we actually grow our brain. So, for instance, a child who grows up listening to music, their brain, you can look at it on a scan and see different things than you would with a child who has sensory deprivation. We know that the brain actually grows differently. Well, one of the ways our brains grow differently is when we snap and take any religious interpretation as a kind of an absolute truth that defines everything. Now, we don't have to ask questions. We just trust whatever it is we say we trust. That kind of neurological development actually changes the way people operate. And so certain types of people who are attracted to that and never get out and don't question, I think actually have a neurological disorder. So, you know, this may be a little bit too cute, but one of the things I say in the book is that religion is a neurological disorder and faith is the only cure. And what I mean by that is that when you have a religious series of doctrinal convictions and you're saying, I'm going to judge everything by that, you obviously have lost faith because faith is really the business of questioning and looking at things in an open way and holding on to certain things and rejecting others. I mean, that's what builds faith rather than just sort of this neurological disorder of becoming a certainty addict. So what we're dealing with in America right now is that two houses of Congress, and whoever this presidential candidate will be kicked out will either are either true believers who actually are certainty addicts, or, just as bad, they have to pretend they are to get through the caucuses and all the other processes and get the religious right folks on their side. And, of course, there's a cynical, very filthy side to this, and that is people like the Koch brothers, you know, don't give a crap about any of this, but they see an opportunity to get lower middle class white people, the people that H.L. Mencken used to call the bourgeoisie, to vote against their own economic interests based on winding them up all the time on some social issue, whether it's gay marriage or abortion or feminism or whatever it may be, to keep them mad enough to actually keep voting for billionaires to become trillionaires while, you know, their own minimum wage job at Walmart or wherever it is keeps being devalued. So there's a really dirty game being played on a very high level, but it can't be understood unless you understand that the only ammunition these guys have to keep firing at the rest of us is to keep all these people angry on some topic, whether it's gay marriage or whatever else it is. So there's always some enemy that has to be stopped in order to save America and get it back to the true believers. And then on the other hand, you have a few people like the Koch brothers who are playing a much deeper game, and that is they're simply using this rube element to continue to crank out winning electoral processes and votes in places like West Virginia, whatever it may be, to have the ability to do what they want to do, which is simply to keep cornering the economy in their own favor. And that's a totally different deal, but it's part of the problem.
Well, let me then go out into the macro, if we may.
Sure.
And that is to ask when we talk about the ascendancy of the religious right, you make it clear that your father Francis Schaeffer was kind of a single issue guy. That it was the light went on for him about abortion.
Right.
But as you note, they have since metastasized into other areas of culture. They don't like liberals. They love guns. They don't like gay people. They're not very crazy about immigrants. They are defined more by what they do not like than that which they do.
Well, yeah, and they deny climate change. They deny biology and evolutionary science. You know, the list goes on.
And here in West Virginia, which is Central Appalachia, so-called coal country, evangelical Protestant churches are hotbeds of dominionism.
Right, exactly, and the whole Reconstructionist movement, and we're going to bring it back and reapply Old Testament law, on.
And I saw you, in an article that I saw by you at Salon, you used pretty strong words in describing the Protestantism of, well, what used to be mainline Protestantism, as having been infected by Reconstructionism.
Yeah, it has been. And
can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I mean, the general public has never heard of Rousseff, Rush Dooney, or Gary North, or Chilton, or any of these guys. But, you know, by the time it got to people like Charles Colson, who was an evangelical leader who was taking these Reconstructionist ideas, the public has felt the impact. And essentially, the Reconstructionist movement emerged out of the late 50s and early 60s, and they were folks who said, we've got to go back to Old Testament law and apply it in a way that any regular old evangelical would have been shocked at. In other words, literally stone gay people to death.
Stone disobedient children,
yeah,
exile people from the tribe
children,
who...
In other words, all the harsh stuff in Leviticus that most Christians would say after Jesus came, this no longer applies. You know, there's a whole theology of that. They wanted to go back to that. In other words, and this is not a stretch, they are to Christianity what ISIS is to Islam, or what the Taliban or Al-Qaeda is to Islam.
That's where we most frequently refer to them as Taliban Christianists.
Right. These are the guys who, in the best of all worlds, you would be killed for being a homosexual. You would be killed for being an adulterer. You would be stoned to death if you're a disobedient child.
And yet they have quietly gone about the business of, as your term, infecting or infesting Christian structures in this country.
Things. Now, most of the evangelicals are smart enough to know that this doesn't fly, and you're not going to get many people following along. And so there's a sort of a watered-down version of it, and the watered-down version suddenly shows up in things where you have, like, Hobby Lobby and Wheaton College and others suing and going to the federal courts to try to say, hey, we want exemptions from applying civil rights laws to gay people or to women to provide contraceptives with our insurance policy. And where it comes from is this idea that somehow if you're a Christian, you are outside and above the law because you are living according to the Bible that trumps the law. And of course, if you look at this logically, you can't have a democracy or a republic based on that. It becomes a theocracy. So these are the watered down versions, but they lead to the same direction, and that is it would be a sort of a Christian version of Iran or Saudi Arabia.
Well, have the rank and file, and I think this is actually a critical question, Frank, have the rank and file actually pondered the ultimate outcome of what it is that they're being used as cannon fodder in the culture war for?
No, because the emotional pull here is what I call victimology, and that is they are always thinking of themselves as victims in spite of the fact that George W. Bush was one of their own and was in the White House, in spite of the fact they control both houses of Congress, in spite of the fact that campaign contribution laws have been loosened to the point where they can take secret money from enormous sources like the Koch brothers and put them into their PACs. They've got all kinds of winning hands on the political front, demonizing President Obama, et cetera, et cetera. But they think of themselves as victims. And so where this comes out is that we've got to take America back because we're being persecuted. Now, they see, for instance, that a child's being taught science as persecution. They see climate change and global warming as a kind of an attempt to subvert capitalism. One thing that's very weird, and I know this is kind of a little bit of a caveat offshoot here, but I've got to say it. You know, back when I was in the 60s and 70s and the 80s even, the evangelical movement, okay, it got off the rails. It was no longer just about bringing people to Jesus. It was also about abortion. But the fact is, if you had told people back then that they were going to sign off on an anti-environmental policy as part and parcel of the Christian stand, or that they were going to be pro-coal company, pro-big oil, pro-Exxon, and anti-the environment, they would have looked at you like you were crazy. But what happened is the osmosis went both ways, and so the evangelical right infected the Republican Party with the social issues, but the Republican movers and shakers, like the Koch brothers and the oil and the coal business people, sort of got their pound of flesh. They came back and said, okay, fine, but, you know, these issues, too, are part of the deal. So now, if you look at evangelicalism as its political portrait, you know, the thrust of it today, it's a sort of a weird mixture of some Christianity, a lot of Ayn Rand's libertarian greed philosophy.
Who was notoriously, hatefully anti-Christian.
Yeah, right. And a huge dose of anti-environmental people. And then, you know, so if you really look at it, if you just read the words of Jesus in the New Testament, okay, forget that we know anything. Let's just say we're from another planet. We find this book and we say, let's underline all this stuff in red and read these words. And then you said, okay, if you believe this, if you follow this guy, Jesus, it means that what you are for is arming yourself to the teeth. You are against women's rights when he, you know, was dealing with women in an open way that people still don't achieve today, by the way. And that was back in the Middle East 2,000 years ago. I mean, if Jesus was nothing but a feminist, that would be what you'd have to say he was. You know, you're gonna be open carry gun laws is what you're for. Unlimited stockpiling of weapons and ammunition because you're following Jesus. You're gonna be against the environment. You're going to be for the rape of your planet and the ecosystems that you say God created. On and on and on. I mean, honestly, you would not be able to convince anyone that you were following Jesus. Somehow, evangelicalism has become something when it's politicized by the right, throw the oil business, all the rest of it. It is so far away from anything related to Jesus that, honestly, I don't think this is a stretch to say the direction of the religious right has pulled Christianity and is actually an antichrist. And I don't mean in the sense of the antichrist.
No, not the Bruga, no.
But I mean, you are against Jesus. You are if Jesus was real and means anything, the enemies of Jesus in this country today are not the atheists or the new atheist movement, because they're not harming anything about Jesus.
Atheists uniformly say, believe what you wish, just don't ask us to.
Right, but if you say you're following Jesus, but you're against helping poor people, and you're against medical care for the indigent, and you are against, and you are pro-gun, and you are all these other things, and you are anti-environmentalist, you know, literally, this is a kind of a blasphemous twisting of,
well,
the message
we had,
of Scripture that, by the way, would have made the old-timing guys, I mean, if you rolled this back 100 years, they would have looked at you like you were nuts. I mean,
yeah.
you're into raping the planet, and treating the poor like crap. This is Christianity? I mean, since when? So this coup has completely undone the message of Christianity itself.
Well, just a couple of weeks ago, and I ask you this because you've verged onto it, and let me thank you, Frank, for the time that you have given us this evening.
No problem.
Can we do just a few more questions, please?
Yeah, I had this down to end at about 7, so, you know, we can go to like 7:05, and then I've got something else that's happening.
Okay, great. Then let me try to get to the heart of the matter.
Sure.
Just as a restatement, I had a minister from a metropolitan community church, a lovely woman by the name of Reverend Marilyn Bowens, on a couple of weeks ago, and
yeah,
she said straight up that these right-wing evangelicals are engaged in a straight-up heresy. They are in
right.
error. And,
right.
by that, I was calling on her to say, you know, that these are not Christians.
No, it is not, by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, you don't look at an individual and judge the person. However, as a movement, if you know, if being for the oil company and against the little guy, you know, you're pushing, you know, anybody who stands up in the name of Jesus and says we shouldn't be paying minimum wage is not following the Jesus of the New Testament. I mean, there's no way around this. Come on, let's stop kidding ourselves.
And secondly, just so people can understand where we are right now, is it your understanding or is it your opinion that the religious right, evangelicals as I call them, that they are fading or waning? Will losing in the Supreme Court on gay marriage make them all just fold their tents and go away? Or is a multi-billion-dollar tax-free industry at this point just about self-sustaining?
I think the multi-billion tax-free industry is self-sustaining, and the greed factor is too huge. You know, the megachurch greed factor is too huge to have anybody walk away from it on one hand, and the access to power and the kind of adrenaline rush you get from that on the other is addictive, as I know because I was there 30, 40 years ago. And then on the other hand, you've got the Republican Party itself cannot let these people wander off. They are their base.
Well, the Republican Party dries up and blows away without them, doesn't it?
Yeah, it will. Eventually, maybe things will change, demographics and all the rest of it, but it's going to be a very slow process. No, this is not going away. I mean, look, you know, Ted Cruz and these guys are the reaction to our first African-American president, and those reactions to Supreme Court decisions and other things will simply harden the resolve. And as we know from history, you know, a dedicatedly angry, tightly knit minority can wreak havoc. I mean, look at what's happening to the Muslim world. I mean, how your average Muslim is not burning someone to death in a cage to make a point. It doesn't take too many people to radicalize the situation. And so we've got our own version. We've got our own Taliban here. And sadly, they're not going away. And the only way they can be contained is through the electoral process of people really starting to vote their conscience in spite of party affiliation.
Evolutionarily, how does what your father started morph into, for instance, C Street?
Well, evolutionarily, it morphs perfectly, because if you look at C Street, for instance, and all this group of evangelicals trying to infiltrate Congress on purpose by putting a hostel there where congressmen can stay when they're away from home and all the rest of it, and then there are shenanigans overseas in places like Uganda and other things where they've criminalized gay behavior and all the rest of it that goes with it, it morphs perfectly, because if you read some of my dad's books, like A Christian Manifesto, for instance, and his call to return America to its Christian base, you know, this is the siren call of a group of people who want to interpret American history in a way that somehow gives them an upper hand today and doesn't take into count two things. First of all, America had a humanistic origin, not a Christian origin. Without the French Enlightenment and everything that went with it, Jefferson and these other people would never have been entertaining the thoughts they entertained. This has nothing to do with the Puritan founding of our country. That's a completely different foundational beginning. And then the second thing is the real answer to, you know, what did the founding fathers want is so what? Because we're a free people. The real issue is who do we want to be in the future? What kind of a country do we
want
exactly. to be?
Well, exactly. If we have to fall back on the founding fathers, then we are no better than the ancient Peruvian societies who said that,
right.
that the dead rulers maintained a grip on their own property and the next guy had to go build his own new palace.
The slave trade would have to be revived immediately and a lot of other things too.
And so, you know, isn't it a standing notion of American philosophy and jurisprudence that life belongs to the living?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what you're finding here is also disingenuous from another point of view, because, of course, it's totally selective. If you really wanted to go back, say, let's just say you get somebody like Ted Cruz who selectively quotes some Puritan father. Okay, I live in New England. When I walk over to Newburyport, Massachusetts, I walk around the village green that was called the Commons, because it was owned in common by a community that would, by today's Republican standards, be judged socialist. Because you had to graze your cattle on common land. You couldn't have private property in the center of town. Everybody had to not only pay the tax, but you got fined if you didn't go to the meeting house and church and vote. There was all kinds of a setup for compulsory education, compulsory care for the indigent. Actually, the New England Bay State Puritan communities did a lot of things wrong. But the funny thing is, you know, when you look at the economic structure of the New England communities that we supposedly hark back to fondly as having been founded by Christians, well, their version of Christianity was that you couldn't have homeless people and indigent people, but it was the community responsibility.
Because that was the heart of American exceptionalism.
Absolutely.
Which has been since perverted.
Read a biography of John and Abigail Adams. I mean, they were definitely Christians by any evangelical stretch of the imagination, and yet they were the people who basically believed that the most important thing in life was education.
Well,
and that the state ought to pay for it.
Well, I don't want to make you late for anything, Frank, but one, may I impose upon you at some date in the hopefully near future that we might continue this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know where to reach me, and we'll set it up for a little longer next time if you have more questions.
And secondly, just the walk away question, isn't it up to those Christians who aren't sucked in by the religion industry right wing hate hustle?
Right.
I'm not the guy who can go to Christianity and say you got to fix it. And I get the
right.
sense that even given your pedigree, you're not that guy either.
No, because you're either in or out. I mean,
they
used to be that guy, but they don't care because, you know, I don't toe the whole line. I mean, they're like the old Communist Party. You're either a member in good standing or you're nothing.
So with that understood, how do you light, to use the language we both understand, how do you light the revivalist fire under the
right.
under Kumbaya Christianity to help them understand that they're being run out of their own church?
Well, essentially it is happening. I mean, the good news is you have a whole progressive Christian movement. You know, your listeners would be interested in a website called patheos.com, P-A-T-H-E-O-S.com, P for Paul, A-T-H-E-O-S.com, that I write for, and I also write for Salon and Huffington Post and a bunch of other people, but Patheos has a section called the Progressive Christian Section, and it is actually it's a very successful site, and they have a tremendous number of readers. I mean, literally millions of people who read the articles on there, not just my stuff, but other people's as well. Okay, these sites 20 years ago never existed. They didn't exist 10 years ago, and I'm not just talking about the technology. There was no equivalent in print. There is an entire movement of progressive Christianity that has sprung up to try to fill this vacuum. So there are, you know, people like, you know, Brian McIron, other writers, people such as myself, you know, we weren't around. We didn't have any audience that would have vaguely called themselves Christians. Now we do. So I would just say to people flailing around out there who want to have some spiritual life to their existence and who want this connected in some way to the Christianity that they hanker after that is a truer and better form than what they're offered by the evangelical churches. There are alternatives. And if you go to a place like patheos.com and look at the writers there on the Progressive Christian page, you'll find a lot of people and even in the religion section on Huffington Post and other places. So there are voices now springing up trying to fill the vacuum, and whether, you know, they in the end convince enough people to really change the landscape, that's a different issue. But there are those voices out there now. This is not like it was 15, even 20, 10 years ago.
Well, Frank Schaefer, this conversation, the first we've ever had, has absolutely flown by. And I've got people writing to me saying I could listen to Frank for the rest of the night.
Well,
I'll
open a good bottle of wine and sit here, and if they want to hang with me, we'll do it.
But now you mentioned writing at Pathos and Salon.
Do
you maintain your own website?
Yeah, I mean, I do answer my email too, and they just have to hit contact on frankschaefer.com. That's just FrankSchaefer, frankschaefer.com.
And
hit contact, and I'll get back to them. And then I've got another site, frankschaeferart.com. But then,
and I want to talk about your art.
You know,
at some point.
Just like my, you know, find me on Facebook. Like my Facebook page. I get up every morning and answer the messages on Facebook. It's not a personal page. It's what they call a fan page, only because I got too many people. But I read all my messages and I answer them, and I'm talking about the actual, you know, post a message. So there's a lot of ways to get in touch with me. And Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God is available on Amazon and in Barnes & Noble bookstores and everywhere else.
That was my next question. It's available at all the usual suspects.
Yeah, I mean, you can get it on Barnes & Noble, on Kindle. You can get the hardcover, the regular book on Amazon or in Barnes & Noble bookstores, or you can just get it off Kindle and like anything else.
I've got it on my Kindle right here. Frank Schaefer, thank you so very much. I wish you a lovely evening and the best of everything until we talk again.
Yeah, and I look forward to it. I really enjoyed this. Thanks.
Thank you very kindly.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. Frank Schaefer, witness to history, one of the best expositors of the means by which the religion industry accomplished its political coup in the United States. Author of Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Create Beauty, Give Love, and Find Peace. Available Barnes & Noble, Amazon, brick-and-mortar bookstores, electronic, you name it. My profound thanks to Frank for joining us in this conversation this evening. The difficulty with these dynamic conversations is that, from my perspective, it kind of ruins my head for going back into what I lovingly refer to as the swamp. But March we will, after we take a little break. The lines are open. And I encourage you to jump in, 304-574-8178 and 304-663-HORN, 304-663-4676. Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. It's that easy. If you've never done it before, send me a contact request that way, and we'll be conversating in no time flat. Got it? Email comes into bobkincaid@gmail.com, BOBKINCAID @gmail.com. Bob Kincaid on Facebook, @BobKincaid on Twitter. It is almost impossible not to get hold of me. So I hope you will add your voice to the discussion this evening after a break. Remember, we try to raise $150 every evening. We are at zero now, and I hope we won't stay that way for too terribly long. This is Conversation Radio. This is Conversation Radio you make. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Mountain. Mm-hmm.
Everybody got a wall. Everybody's got to walk. No, there ain't no free ride. Everybody's got to walk. You might have angel wings. You might be tied to a wheelchair. Maybe a jet plane pilot. You might be nothing but thin air. You might be a Muslim, you might be Hindu, you might be Christian, you might be a Jew, but everybody's got to walk, everybody got to walk, ain't no free ride, everybody's got to walk.
You can get much more appropriate than that. Kevin Welch, 1999, an album called Beneath My Wheels. Everybody's Gotta Walk. This is the Horn Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Plate's been passed around the congregation and came back with an echo in it. Oh, well, let's go straightway over to the phones. I do believe we have Jim in Colorado. Hey, Jim.
What's up, Bob?
What do you know?
Great, great interview, man. That was fan-freaking-tastic. On so many levels. I mean, there's like one, you know, my two little engagements with the religion industrial complex. It was like a little bit when I was like 12, and I, there's a little Presbyterian church, and I kind of got into it. Yeah, mainly kids kind of waved me little checks, and then Jesus gave me a brain aneurysm, another one, and then I just kind of never went back to it. But even then, I remember going to, before the brain aneurysm, song and dance happened. We went to a bookstore, a Christian bookstore. And do you know what book I bought?
No, what?
Mad Magazine on religion. I think you like that too much. I bought Mad Magazine on religion. Edition of other compilation of stuff, and that was great. And then my next step was when about 19, then I got into and he couldn't tell you Buddhism, which seemed pretty cool. But right off the bat, they told you, you know, I said, well, I've read a whole bunch of Alan Watts, blah, blah, and I think we've already been through that, and other books. And they're like, oh, no, that's all false. And I've noticed that about religions, a lot of religions. I guess maybe particularly fundamental.
Well, and it's that us or nobody else approach that ruins a lot of people on any form of organized religion, Jim. Because when you get right down to it, it's not just okay. If you're not a Christian, you're going to hell. You know, the Christians subdivide themselves on which Christians are going to heaven. I grew up in a community. I think I've told this story before. I grew up in a community where the dominant religion. Well, I was a Baptist, and we were kind of normal, because that entire community was ruled by the Church of Christ, which in its inception were called the Campbellites, and they were a weird bunch. I mean, weird with a capital, ooh. These are people who would not allow so much as a kazoo or a tambourine into their church, because there was a verse in Psalms that says, sing and make melody in thy hearts. And they were hardcore. They were convinced that they had the pass key into heaven. In fact, all the other, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, the Baptists, the Lutherans, the Catholics, all told the same joke, that a pious and upright person dies and goes to heaven, and St. Peter is giving the pious upright person the tour of eternal paradise. And he says, and over there's the Methodist, and the Methodists go, hey. And they walk along a little bit, and there's the Baptist. The Baptists go, hey! And the pious person goes, hey! And there's the Catholics, hey, hey! There's the Presbyterian, hey, hey! Until they get to the, and they goes, and there's the Church of Christ. And the pious newly elect raises his hand to wave, and St. Peter says, shh, Pat. Well, why not? They think they're the only ones up here.
And it's so weird, and I think I've said this before, I'll bring it up again, because to me it's so blatantly obvious that the majority of what religion you believe in, I didn't frame that right, but the vast congregating factor, the thing that's going to make you believe in a certain religion, you have no control over. It's location, location, location. A lot of things are
You are not going to be a Christian if you are born in Islamabad.
Yeah. Unless you're, like, really hard up for some abuse. Well, I mean,
you're probably not going to find it. I mean, it's not going to be an option. So,
the way I got into Zen Buddhism or Buddhism was when I was 14 or 15, and I was in a bookstore, and this book always just hit my head. I don't watch the way it's in. That's da 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 da. And I, after three or four trips, I said, well, let's. Dyslexic screw that I am, I will try and get it and read through another part of it and make more sense than the other stuff. And from then on, you know, it's kind of a Buddhist thing. I got my little Nietzsche and Shoshu thing and blah, blah, blah. I'm repeating myself. But then once I got into their little group, first, like I told you, first day, first night, okay, I went to the little, they were chanting, there was a meeting, it was cool. And I mentioned previous references, I'm like, well, yeah, that's really great. You will live here now for a reason. That wasn't their exact words, but that was implicitly implied. And I'm sure that's with 90-some-odd% of religions. You know, it's like, I kind of accidentally stumbled into this situation. I'm curious about you guys, and that's how they reel you in, you know. They just, and and that guy was great. I forgot his name.
Frank Schaefer.
Frank Schaefer. Yeah. He was fantastic.
I think so too, and he's one of those folks who are so easy and genial in conversation that I could easily have burned up 3 hours with him, and I don't think we ever would have gone back. I don't think we ever would have crossed back over a previous topic.
See, I see a lot of similarities. I mean, it's different religions, but it's the same old song and dance. It's the same old song and dance, and it's like when I was 19, I asked my dad, what do you think happens when you die? And he said, just looked at me. And my dad basically had a stoic face, a sad stoic face, and a joyous stoic face. And I guess it was kind of a joyous stoic face. He said, nothing, you're dead. That's what he said. And even then, when I was practicing Buddhism, he never practiced compliment. Yeah, it seems like it's working out for you. But he never tried to sway me or anything. It took me five or six years to like, man, this is just dogmatic bullshit, you know? I just kind of shifted onto that Rolling Stones song, you know, you got to move.
And see, that's what that goes back to what Frank said about absolutists. If you have any ability to question authority, if you have any ability to dig deeply and if you want to use your intellect at all. You're not going to work out over in a whole bunch of Christianity. It ain't going to work. You're not going to be happy. The only way you're going to be happy is if you completely put away everything you ever thought you knew about life, the universe, and everything, and just accept what some guy in a pulpit who may not be as educated as you are is saying. You know, because he's got the secret decoder ring and the earpiece that's connected directly to the Almighty.
No, you're totally right. It's like now you're saying that, I'm thinking that there were only like two occasions that I ever and nothing I noticed with a lot of sales groups or quote unquote business opportunities, entrepreneurships, they kind of mixed in that Christianity a little bit. Now I haven't been to many yet, but I always notice it's kind of subtly tucked in there. I mean, imagine you being a man worth seven or eight figures. You don't have to worry about that. But I mean, have you ever run into people like trying to, well, here's how you make some money, and then you go to the thing. And then it's like I'm basically talking about that Amway scam.
Oh, sure,
Any other version of that?
A million years ago, when I was studying classical guitar, we got about a year into it, and it was obvious I was pretty serious about it. And the next thing you know, my guitar teacher invites me to, and lo and behold, there it was, an Amway pitch. And I thought, son of a gun, is nothing sacred?
Well, it's like a friend of mine, this is 2.5 decades ago, whatever, said, come on, this is the way to make money, this, make some money. And I said, this is an Amway. He said, no, I go to it, goddamn Amway.
Is this Amway? No, it's Amway. Oh, so it's not Amway? Definitely it's Amway. Yeah, no.
It's the new improved Amway. It's the new improved Scamway. Now, if you can just get, it's just like any of those multi-level things. If you can just get everybody in your family and their offspring, I mean, you have to go really far down the DNA line, and then they all have to buy that, every laundry detergent, toilet paper from them. Yeah, that's, it's just, it's comical. So, on that note, glad I was the first caller in. That guy was fantastic.
Yeah, wait, you're the first caller. Wait a minute. We don't have much to give here, but you get one of these, Jim.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Man, I feel that's not just because I'm on a Rocky Mountain High.
It all has a new meaning now, doesn't it?
Yeah, but not. I could still pass the drug test. No, I just think positive.
Understandable. Probably won't be that way for too terribly much longer, though, I can imagine.
Well, that's like another thing. I'm not totally clear on everything out here, so I'm trying to get used to I guess I saw a sign for a job. It wasn't necessarily geared toward me, but yes, we do drug tests. I don't know if they mean like if you. Okay, so you smoke.
Well, and by the way, that's taking on a new meaning. I have heard. I don't have any. I don't have any empirical data on this, but I've heard out there that places that drug test now, they don't really care if they find some THC in your system because it doesn't mean that you're sideways at the moment. In the modern era. It's the pills. It's the opiates. It's the meth, the roids, you know, what have you.
Well, the only drug I'm going to test positive are caffeine, nicotine, and phenobarbital, and I need that. So I don't.
Well, two of them are legal, and the third one's prescribed, so you're in the clear.
I'm like walking on water and swimming on land.
There you go.
That's King Missile. King Missile. All right, classic King Missile. I'm leaving on that. I'll let somebody else get in. Thank you.
All right, you take care, Jim.
And thank you for that great interview, man. I'm gonna have to re-listen. I missed about 15 minutes of it, but I'm gonna have to catch the rest because that guy was way cool.
And hopefully we'll have him back. Thanks, Jim. Have a good evening.
All right.
Bye now. Our buddy Jim, formerly of Louisiana Stan, now of Colorado. Then we're not putting the stand on there just yet. You know, the thing is, when you have this sort of historical perspective on all this rotten crap that's going on, it does add a little bit of perspective, swamp notwithstanding. It does add a little bit of perspective when you see news stories about what it, you know, the real world effects, the toxic real world effects of it. For instance, consider Baltimore. We talked about it all last night, and I think justifiably so. And I think we probably need to be talking about the underlying causes of Baltimore, because they're going to be the cause of Dallas, or the cause of Kansas City, or the cause of Duluth, or, you know, whatever, wherever this springs up next. And I guess other people are talking about it too, but they're not talking about it in a way that you and I would recognize as being sane. Let me, by way of example, introduce you to an actual bona fide, no kidding, member of the House of Representatives, cat by the name of Bob Flores. Bob, of course, comes to us from Texas. Mm-hmm. And Bob has figured out what really caused the Baltimore riots. Thanks to Robert in Morgantown for bringing this to my attention. Oh, tired old computer. When will you not screw me again? Here we go. Maybe. Oh, for pity's sakes.
I'm sorry I missed you this morning, but you're right. There was a great crowd, and they were enthusiastic, and we had a lot of folks there that support the right to traditional marriage for men and women to have the healthy relationships that build healthy families and healthy kids.
You know, as a member of Congress, and you're dealing with a lot of the issues that a lot of folks never see, but, you know, government is kind of the last stop to fix problems. I would argue they're not the best to fix these problems, but they have to deal with the problems. And a lot.
Oh, for pity's sake! So it's gonna go that way. This is a radio broadcast courtesy of the fine folks at Right Wing Watch, who really take one for the team when they sit down and monitor this stuff. He had attended the rally for, and notice the Orwellian use of language, the right of heterosexual people to be married. Remember what Frank Schaefer said a little bit ago about how they live and breathe by victimology? This is that. He was there a rallying for one man and one woe man outside the Supreme Court of the United States. And then he sat down to talk to Tony, Norman, yes, Mother Bates, Perkins. And this is what you get. And this is a perfect little spumoni of right wing asshattery. On the one hand, somehow or another, the case that was argued yesterday wasn't about whether or not gay people could have the full effect of the 14th Amendment, but instead was about whether or not hetero people could have the right to marry. Even though that has never been impinged and couldn't in a million years. And then, of course, you get Tony Perkins saying, I don't think government's very good at problem solving. It sure took a lot of the bite out of elderly poverty with that Social Security program there, Tony. There's several million people in this country who can go to the doctor when they're sick now because of government, Tony. Yeah, I get it. I get it, Jeremy in Vermont. Isn't it obvious that what caused Baltimore? It's the blah people. You know, so poor, so black thugs. Right. No. That's not it at all. Bob Flores has the answer.
A lot of these problems are created by the breakdown of the family, which the redefinition of would only accelerate.
You're exactly right, Tony. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, let's talk about poverty, for instance. The single largest determinant, the single best indicator of whether or not a child is going to be in poverty or not, is whether or not they were raised by a two-parent household or a single-parent household. And so the breakdown of the family has contributed to poverty. It's contributed, you look at what's going on in Baltimore today, and,
right,
you know, you see the issues that are raised there. And healthy marriages are the ones between a man and a woman because they can have a healthy family and they can raise children in the way that's best for their future, not only.
Yeah, because everybody knows that gay people aren't healthy. God almighty, the depth and the perversity of the sickness that is these evangelicals. So, a child would be better. Never mind the pejoratives. They're just saying that no gay couple can ever raise a child as well as one man and one woman, no matter what flaws or imperfections the one man and one woman may have. I mean, after all, don't you remember my three sons? You know, there was Steve Douglas with his three sons, and they had to bring in Uncle Charlie. Wait a minute. That was three sons being raised by two dudes. Yeah, but remember, by the end of the program, well, standards and practices had decided that Steve Douglas had to finally get married, because it was obvious that those children on that TV show were going straight to hell. Ernie, get that tramp out of here, right?
Socially, but psychologically, economically, from a health perspective, there's just nothing like the traditional marriage that does that for a child. Each of us have a mother and a father, and there's no way to get around that.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You wouldn't be here without a mother or father. And the social science, as you said, is complete in that it shows that children do best when they have a mom and a dad. It's not two caregivers. Because if it were just two caregivers, three might be better, or four or five. No, it's a mom and a dad. They need both. But beyond the core issue of the family and society as a whole, there's another aspect of this when you have all of these states, 31 states that have gone to the polls where the voters have affirmatively expressed support for protecting the natural definition of marriage, to have the courts simply come in and just overrule that, kick all of that out. Nine justices on the United States Supreme Court. That is, I think, a real threat to our republic and our form of government. Do you not? As well,
I agree. It's very scary to think about the fact that the over 50 million voters in this country that have voted to affirm marriage between a man and a woman may have their views overturned by a big, heavy-handed federal government. That's scary. I mean, 80+% of the citizens in this country don't want the government getting involved, in the federal government getting involved in this issue. The federal government is going to get it wrong, and so I think we need to rely on the knowledge that people have back in our communities and back in our state to address this issue. Not judges in any court.
Oh, where's my swirly straw? That's right, that's right. Gay marriage caused the Baltimore riots. I didn't. That wasn't a parody. That was real. You can tune in to the American right wing most any day and hear this kind of lunacy over and over and over again. Charming, aren't they? But when you hear something like that through the prism of what you heard this evening in the first hour from Frank Schaefer, it is both, well, you understand it, you understand the place that it comes from better, and it becomes considerably more terrifying, doesn't it? A lot more terrifying. Oh, we've got a lot to work with this evening on Prayer Meeting Wednesday. I want to thank Will in Chicago for being the first one to help out with fundraising this evening. Thank you very kindly, Will. It is much appreciated. I'm sure Will would love to have some company. And if you'd like to join Will, well, you can go to PayPal and just use bobkincaid@gmail.com for the recipient address. Or you can go through the interface at headonradionetwork.com. Or you can use the U.S. Postal Service. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEYWV, 25801. Both lines for conversation purposes are open. The Gizmo line, 304-663-HORN, we call that Maud, Harold, is 304-574-8178. Uh, Jeremy in Vermont offering translation services. Let me boil down and translate this little circle jerk you just played, Bob. Oh, no, the queers are a-taking over freedom. Hey, Jeremy, you forgot.
Wolverines!
Yeah. Note coming in from Irish Dave. Only a man and a woman can raise healthy, unvaccinated children. And Irish Dave also notes, Jesus, Bob, no matter where he is, no matter where he is, Jim is always mellow Jim. Yes, indeed. Over to the Herald line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, is that me?
That's you, John.
Oh, sorry about that. When you said you had both lines open and I was on hold, I was like, oh, wait a minute.
I'm sorry. I screwed up. I need to stop that. Too much gin on the potato salad before program time.
So I had to redial and call back in. Yeah, that was a great conversation. That opens up a lot of monkey poo flowing if you wanted to get into it. But it does bring up something that if you don't mind, I want to take a slight kind of composite tangent, if you don't mind.
Do your best.
Happened to listen to the podcast version of Dr. Bill, the Monday show.
Uh-huh.
And although I haven't listened to the Tuesday show yet, so I don't know if he maybe takes a slightly different version, but the take that I got from that and what you just talked about here, and please instruct me if I maybe am wrong about this, but I'm really starting to smell, break out the Da Vinci Code music and stuff, and I'm starting to really smell the stench of conspiracy.
Please don't say the Illuminati or the please.
No, but I'm thinking more like your Cokes and your Adelsons and stuff. If they wanted to marshal an army of people to push their agenda, because your guest made a comment that I kind of, maybe I was just geared up to pick it up, but it was a comment that I'm not going to be able to exactly duplicate it, but millions of people that they were brought in don't believe. Koch brothers and the Adelson and stuff, they don't give a rat's rear end about religion.
No. Frank Schaefer is absolutely right in that regard. They're hardcore libertarians, John, and that, right.
Well, I mean, the thought that comes to my mind is here we got, and this is where I'm dovetailing with Dr. Bill, is he's talking about this, about Roberts, how he's planning, he's kind of working out this long-term, incremental step-by-step, which I smell as the total legitimization of corporations as actual people. And that's kind of the gist I got picked up. And maybe I'm wrong about it. Maybe I'm just totally space cadeted it. But that was the gist that I picked up from Monday's conversation with him or the show. And it dovetailed into a thought that I had listening to your interview is that, whichever way you talk about it, you have a group of people that are driven by a outdated, as you call it, Bronze Age mentality, and your guest made a very, I thought, very potent argument of the addiction of certainty. When people, especially older people, the world is changing and they don't like it, they like to be certain. They like to believe that their life is not, that they have been going the wrong way the whole time. And you marshal those forces, get those people voting, and because you got to ask yourself sometimes, and maybe this is just me, but do these people believe so strongly when all the evidence is staring them in the face that the logic just is so, it's right there, and yet they still will cling to it regardless? and then you have all these billionaires tossing cash around.
Well, it's interesting you raise that possibility, John, because let me offer a parallel, if I may.
Please.
You know, as I mentioned last night, I got to thinking about the 19th century in considering what's going on here in the second decade of the 21st, in the form of thinking about John Brown's words. Well, by the time they got around to executing John Brown on December the 2nd, 1859, the abolitionist movement had been in full flower for a couple of decades at least. One of the things you can see, I presume that it's still there, you can see it in the Capitol Museum. When you go and visit the United States Capitol, we the people spent a ton of money building a really cool museum underneath the plaza on the east side of the Capitol. And one of the things you can see there is a desk. And it turns out to have been John Quincy Adams's desk from when he served in the House of Representatives. And you can also see there a motion that he made, which was not even taken up by the House, regarding slavery. Because the House of Representatives had passed a resolution saying that the issue of slavery and the issue of abolition would not even so much as be permitted to be mentioned inside the House of Representatives. Now, why do I mention that? I mention that because in the years in which people like William Lloyd Garrison were leading the anti-slavery abolition movement, the other side wasn't just sitting passively back. If you lived in the South and you mentioned abolition, you would probably be as lynched as any runaway slave. And to that end, or with that in mind, I think it's worth noting that we live in a country now where the evangelical religion industry has successfully ginned up. And understand, those anti-abolitionist people, you know, some of them didn't even own slaves. Some of them were dirt farmers, okay? They did not have a dog in the hunt except for the fact that they were ginned up by the ruling elite to think that they did. Well, consider marriage equality. Honest to God, unless you are a closeted gay man who is in a heterosexual, otherwise heterosexual marriage, gay marriage means nothing to you. It absolutely is totally, completely, utterly impossible that two guys picking out a China pattern together could have an impact on a couple who's been married for 40 years in Dubuque. With me?
Mm-hmm.
But they have been co-opted to believe, and believe is the important word here because it is the single most dangerous word in the English language. They've been co-opted to believe that because those two guys can pick out a China pattern and get married, that Emery and Marvelline's marriage is on the rocks. Well, if you compare those two things, what the right-wing evangelical religion industry has done in this country is over the span of the last 30 years or so, they have laid the groundwork for the same sort of army that the Confederacy raised. And I've argued for years that we are in the midst of a cold civil war. I think at a moment's notice it can go hot at a word from Tony Perkins, at a word from Louis Gohmert, Steve Cantaloupe King, and people should have it funded by the Koch brothers. Because remember that yes, absolutely, the Civil War was about slavery, but it had economic implications for the power elite, the moneyed elite. And if you go back and you look at the Confederate Declaration of Independence, it reads like a libertarian wet dream. So if the Koch brothers decide to fund something like that, then the emerging secessionist movement will be a libertarian wonderland. Make no mistake where the libertarians land on this issue. Pure libertarians may say, oh, hell, it don't make no... I'm a libertarian. I ain't none of my business. But that also has been largely co-opted by the religion industry. Witness, for instance, Rand Paul's nuanced response to gay marriage, which is to, of course, bow and scrape and kowtow to the bigots and the homophobes. So if you take all of that together, you can actually posit the balkanization of the United States, because you know what? I'll take it one step further. I don't think we would fight the Civil War this time around. I think if Texas and Mississippi and Arkansas and Georgia and Tennessee decided to leave, I think this time through we'd probably say good riddance, goodbye, Godspeed, be well, and if I ever speak to you again, my tongue should fall out.
Well, this dials right back to that whole Second Constitutional Convention business. This is a
right, and that's a way to achieve secession without ever firing a shot.
Yeah, do it through the courts, as it were. I mean, you sit there, you call it the religion industry and what have you, and it's very appropriate. And it's the whole push has been incremental, one little foot, stick the nose of the camel under the tent. See if he gets his nose bitten off. No? Well, okay, let's get him up to his eyebrows. Still hadn't quite gotten his face. He got punched once or twice, but still there. Well, let's stick his whole head in now. And he might have got kicked a couple of times, but he's still there. And before long, as you say, the pig's got all four trotters in the damn trough. They're stepping into it. And that's, like I said, I'm taking this maybe in an odd direction, but it's just got that smell of cigar room, back room cigar smoke. Some guy sat down one day, like you were talking with Dr. Bill. You go back to your cow doctor. I mean, this stuff, it's a freaking roadmap, and you're seeing every freaking step along the way. The co-option of the media through like Fox News and AM radio and stuff, and a constant litany of, pound, 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 tell them whatever bullshit they got to tell them, but you say it enough times and they're going to believe it. And then you got your business interests that are just, gut the country, because if we had a thriving middle class people that are well off, have time and have benefits, can go out and vote without losing pay, without feeling being scared to death every few minutes. But you get them all poor, you get them all struggling, you get them all sitting there wondering, is my job going to be here next week or next month or next year? If they're worried about putting food on the table, they're not worried about what politics are going down the pike. And that's just kind of the way I see it. It just opens up the door to, just like I said, I just get this muggy little stench that, that Machiavellian plan is just going bit by bit, and next 20, 30 years, maybe your estimate might be right. This country may not be here anymore, at least not in the shape and form that we've always known it to be. And now that I've depressed everybody, I'll go away.
I don't think it's depressing, John. I don't think that paying attention to reality is ever depressing. Although, I worry, John, that when we talk about these kinds of possible futures, that we might verge over into Alex Jones land, but I really don't think we do. I mean, down in Texas, as we speak, I don't know if you know, really, I saw this or not, but... down in Texas, they got all nervous because some members of the U.S. military were going to be doing what the U.S. military does. From time to time, the U.S. military has exercises.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we probably all remember when Gomer Pyle went on exercises, and he told Sergeant Carter that if there was trouble, he'd use the old owl call. Hooty hoot! Hooty hoot! Right? Remember Hooty hoot?
Mm-hmm.
Well, word got out about Operation Jade Helm, and suddenly all the knuckle-breathing, mouth-walking, floor-rolling, strychnine-swigging, tongue-speaking, gun evangelical gundamentalists in Texas had decided that the time had finally come when that one in our White House, the secret Kenyan Muslim, was going to invade Texas and take everybody, use the United States military to take everybody's guns. No shit, really.
Well, it's not that surprising since that's actually where I am right now, is sitting a few miles outside of Houston. And usually about once a day as I'm driving down to my destination, I'll flip it over to AM radio and just let the scanner do its scanning thing. It picks up
the magic button.
Yeah, the magic button. And that was the first I heard about it, was the local... I had when I was passing through Dallas-Fort Worth, a couple of local channels were talking about, it's awful, it's awful concerning that they come in here and they're not telling us what they're doing, and it's a secret mission, and I'm going, and it took me a while. I had to get on the damn internet and start looking at what the hell were they talking about.
Yeah, this is Bastrop County, Texas, and it's called Operation Jade Helm 15. And Lieutenant Colonel Mark Lastoria even had a community meeting for the mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, etc. of Bastrop County. And they jammed, I think it was a high school gym. You couldn't wedge another teabagger in with a crowbar. And the colonel said, we're going to be conducting these exercises safely and courteously. And that's when a bagger stood up, and there's audio of it, and said, would the court, because they have county courts in Texas, not county commissions, would the court be offended if I told the colonel I don't believe a single word he just said? So Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, and this is hilarious, if not, albeit dangerous, mobilized the Texas National Guard, John,
mm-hmm.
and tasked them with monitoring Jade Helm 15. And in a tweet, Greg Abbott said they were doing it in order to safeguard Texans' constitutional rights, private property, and civil liberties.
And that idiot got elected governor. Jeez, I didn't think somebody could beat Rick Perry, but damn, didn't take him long. Frick, I tell you, this is, it would be funny and. But there is a core of fear that runs through that. Because you wonder, and it's like you said, it's like these riots going off in Baltimore. I sit there and I stopped off at a truck stop to do a diddle and grab me a soda and what have you on the way down. And that truck stop, they have multiple TVs up on the windows. They have little, like, McDonald's or Wendy's or whatever, and they got little TVs up in the corners and everything. And they all had it turned on Fox News. And that's all you saw, with this constant loop of this. I don't know if it was how big the protest was, but they were looping what looked like a whole bunch of people passing down the street protesting. And they had the blog, the Chiron that was talking about, thousands of people were protesting, and the old governor So the mayors who ordered another curfew, and the governors called the National Guard, and blah, blah, blah. And I happened to be in line, and the guy in front of me, he's looking, and he's got this look on his face like somebody had waved a little bag of dog poop under his nose. And I go, well, what's wrong? And this, and I apologize to any of your people on the air, but I'm all just quoting word verbatim just so you get the full kick out of it. He said, them goddamn niggers don't know when to keep their place. I had to turn around and leave. I just basically looked at the girl because I was getting ready to, you know, we're getting ready, we're in line, and I said, okay, that's it, I gotta go because I'm about to tear off on this guy's ass. But the thing that bothered me the most about it is it's one thing for one guy to say it. But when three people in line go, yeah, you're right, that goddamn, you know, and I'm like, oh man, I just walked
out. No, that's like what happens when I go down to the little convenience. Well, I've stopped going to that convenience store. I don't go there anymore because I just get sick of hearing it. But I walk in there and it's N-word this and N-word that and that Obama, Kenyan, Muslims. You know, when I do the funny voices and kid around here, John, they come from reality, and you apparently go around the country and you hear the reality that it comes from.
Oh yeah, I see it every day. Like I said, I can pretty much figure. Although I occasionally will hear it up north, but at least up north, I guess maybe they're a little more circumvent about it. But down, if I go past I-40, pretty much, if I'm I-40 or south, forget it. The more, and again, part of it's because of the profession I'm in. I mean, truck drivers are good people. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of good ones out there.
The salt of the earth.
But there is a significant minority of the people that are in these trucks and out here driving these roads. You know, the one thing about being a truck driver is that, you know, you've got some pretty educated ones out here because of the jobs are, but a good portion of them are like me. They don't have a great education and they don't have a lot of options as far as making it happen. But they sit there and they drive for hundreds of miles and they listen to AM radio day in and day out. You got Sirius Radio. They got iTunes and stuff, I'm listening to you now on that on my phone, which is why I sometimes have trouble switching back and forth because I got you on the phone and on the phone. So it's like, I got to make sure I got everything shut off right. But, you know, they have channels like, Sirius Right.
On Sirius. No. It's Sirius Patriot, Sirius Right, Sirius D-Bag. No, the right wing has a million channels on Sirius. We get Sirius Left.
One miserable channel, and it's like, for instance, Netroots. I got Netroots on the same block, and I listen to them on a couple shows on them. And Netroots can't even fill up their entire day with shows.
No, and it's very John. We'll stop here for a moment of shameless self promotion. It drives me crazy. I would love to know how to get through to Sirius. I mean, we've only been doing this for 10 years. We're not some recent startup. This program could go wild on a place like Sirius. If all the members of the Hut once wrote whatever the email is at Sirius and said, Jesus Christ, why don't you people get Bob Kincaid on there? Or get the horn on there. I don't even like having it be about me. You know, suddenly the universe of the conversation would expand exponentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, you got a couple things that are probably going to be in your way, and that is that, you know, I don't know what the machinery and mechanics of for Sear is, but, you know, I don't know what kind of revenue streams and funding requirements and all that stuff are.
Oh, look, I do. I do. We can real-time a connection to them on a machine that costs $4,000.
Yeah.
They want it bad enough. We'll take it out. We'll take it out of future revenues or whatever.
Yeah.
But it could be easy. But I don't know. I don't know what's at work there. Maybe they don't want that much left or progressive information out there for fear that people. Wow, this is paranoid. For fear that people might actually make sense of things.
Well, see, that's part of what I was going to bring up. I said, okay, stop and think about it for a moment. Now, granted, it was a piss poor run operation, from what I gather. Although I really wasn't that much into it at the time, but I gathered that Air America was a, you know, at least in its inception.
Oh, Air America was a train wreck. But I wouldn't even say that it was conceived well, because it was conceived to run on a right wing model. And progressive radio is never going to work that way. You spend a horse gagging load of money on New York studios that you're leasing. You lease, mm-hmm. you buy time on AM stations all over the country. That bleeds more money. It was just dumb.
No, if you were to do anything like that, you'd have to do it kind of like what you're doing. You'd have to build it to the ground up.
I know it predates you, but we did it. At the height of the earliest days of the Horn, we were doing 3 hours less of live programming per day than Air America was, and we did it on nothing. At the same time that Air America was hemorrhaging $80,000 a day, we had a dedicated group of volunteer broadcasters, people like Peter Godbold, Guy James, me, Dr. Bill, Joe Vecchio, John Fox, and we filled up a broadcast day. Of course, it didn't last because nobody could, you know, because there was no way to fund it. But we did it, and we did it for a couple of years.
Well, that's the problem about, and I'm not saying it's bad or ill, but it is the problem about being a lefty, and I'll use the term very generically here, mind you. I've always believed, and you please correct me if I'm wrong here, but I've always believed in seeing it in my life. When I first graduated high school, and I was as Republican as Michael Keaton's character on this freaking show. I mean, suit, briefcase, whole nine yards. I thought that was the version of success. But over the course of my life, I've realized something pretty important. And maybe I'm wrong, but it just seems to me the impression I have is that you cannot be rich, or especially become rich, unless you're willing to walk over people's backs to do it, to take advantage of them, to sell them something for more than what it's worth and convince them they're getting a good deal. If you have empathy for these people, you would say, no, I don't want to charge him $2 for a bottle of water when it only costs me 50 cents. Small profit, yes, but I don't need to be, you know, raping and pillaging. But it seems like, you know, people on the left, you go to Austin, you go to San Francisco, you go to Seattle, and almost to a person, the lefties got great hearts, but they ain't got a lick of money. Because they don't really have it in them.
By and large, the rank and file don't, and that's why, you know, this is a radio network that is run by rank and file people, John.
Yeah.
And I recognize that every time $5 comes in, that it represents some level of sacrifice by someone.
Yeah.
That's why the fundraising is as minimal as it is.
Yeah,
that's why we don't sell podcasts. That's why we don't sell memberships. We don't sell anything because we are not engaging in capitalism or profiteering.
Exactly.
And maybe that's why I ain't on Sirius.
Well, that might be, like I said, that might have a part of it to do right there because, you know, they're going to want to, you know, carry an advertisement somewhere around the back end of your show or something, or the front end or whatever.
Hey, look, it's already happening. I mean, I remember when I was getting emails from people saying, Bob, do you realize there's an Exxon Mobil ad going on TuneIn every time I, you know, and we're powerless over that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't have $3,500 to build our own app so that people can use something besides TuneIn or Stitcher.
Yeah. And it's ridiculous. I mean, you sit there and I see. I used to carry the series. Well, it was two companies. Now it's one, Sirius XM now. But when I first got into that stuff, I could at least nominally go, okay, cool. You pay. You got yourself a little card, and you called in. You attach that card. You know that particular prepaid card to your radio, and it run. But then, like every damn thing else in the world, you know, they wanted you to go to a subscription. They wanted to know your email, your address, your freaking DNA profile, your mother's bunion size, all that crap. And so I dropped them, and I refused to go back and get them because I already have enough subscriptions on the freaking thing to tell the damn TuneIn app here, who damn near quizzed me into next week just to get that thing up and running. And every damn 2 or 3 days it wants a freaking update. But, I feel bad. I mean, like I said, I can't promise right at the moment, but I'll see how my checks and stuff work over the weekend. And if it's got anything there, I'll throw something away. But,
well, bless your heart, John. Thank you.
Yeah, like I said, I can't promise it at the moment.
I understand.
It's been a bit of a rough couple of weeks here with, Texas flooded out, so I got jammed up for a couple of days. And that, if I don't move, I don't make money.
Well, right. So, I mean, it's called trucking for a reason. It's not called sitting.
Yeah, it's like your Jim talked about the drug test and stuff, and it's all a shill game. Oh, it's about safety. Now they want to cut your hair, find out what drugs you're taking and stuff. And I'm like, you know, when's enough enough? We live in a right wing world.
You can cut my hair when you take it from my. No, never mind.
Well, no, I mean, they can cut my hair if they want to, but the thing, the part that bothers me is that it has nothing to do with safety because, you know, it's like, to me, the hypocrisy is you've got things like, say, marijuana. It's legal. I'm waiting for the case, and I know it's got to be coming somewhere. Some trucker is going to get pissed off who lives in Colorado who's going to say, it's legal. I can do recreational marijuana in my state.
No, nope. Privity
at.
Of contract. Booze is legal too, but you can't get behind the wheel drunk.
No, I'm not saying you can do that, but I'm saying the way.
No, the issue is whether or not having it in your bloodstream, because cannabinoids stay in your bloodstream for a month. The issue is, does having it in your bloodstream amount to the same thing as being under the influence of it? And the obvious answer is no.
Right.
Short-term memory issues notwithstanding. What were we talking about? No.
Yeah.
Hey, John, have yourself a good evening.
Oh, I apologize. I got the.
Oh, no apology necessary.
I forgot what time it was. Catch you later.
All right, you take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Our buddy John calling from the road. Lots of good word coming in about the conversation with Frank Schaefer. Note from Ken a couple of minutes ago. Says, thanks for your interview with Frank Schaefer. I'm sure he enjoyed it because he didn't have to take a break. And this kind of goes to what John and I were talking about. Ken says, I'm sure he enjoyed it because he didn't have to take a break every 5 minutes and then spend another two to re-explain what we were talking about. Ken says, brother, your show is the best. Thank you, Ken. It's the kind of thing that makes it worth doing. Ron and Raleigh with a note says, don't you just love post-racial America? America spelled with 3 K's. I'd like to know just what is my place. Serving as the scare quotes in that instance. Well, just ask them, Ron. They'll be happy to tell you. Because so many of them are at least they try, some of these right-wingers, to stay somewhat closeted. But if you just give them half a chance, like I said, going down to the convenience store, what John heard, I think back to the old MASH TV series. Before Harry Morgan ever became Colonel Potter, there was a wonderful, hilarious episode in which he played a gone mad as a hatter army officer who revealed himself as That's quite the racist. Oh, no, before you go, a tune. What's your place? They'll tell you. When the sun goes down and the moon comes out. Oh, Jesus. Okay, back to some other stuff. One thing, one thing that I think bears mentioning that is a subtext to everything going on in Baltimore. I saw this mentioned. At the beginning of the month, like April 8th. And I had it in the stack, and somehow never got around to it, and I have not seen a follow-up on it. I would be interested if anyone has a follow-up on it. Because it does feel subtextual. First of all, in the wake of the mass arrests that have followed, let's see, what's the journalism speak? The unrest in Baltimore. I'm sorry, but 99% of the for-profit media is just a joke to me. Erin Burnett getting schooled on her use of the word thug. I'm sure you've seen that clip by now. But Joan Shipps over at Raw Story has the story. It's headlined, "Hundreds languish behind bars without charges or a shower as Baltimore struggles with mass arrests." Because, see, we can have all these highfalutin constitutional ideas, but if you don't have the ability to put them into practice, into play, they're pretty much meaningless. I've argued for years what I call the Tinkerbell theory of the Constitution, insofar as the Constitution and Tinkerbell are the same. If you don't believe in either one of them, they die. So we have, for instance, constitutional rights in this country to be promptly arraigned on charges brought against you. In Maryland, the state code requires that anyone arrested get a court appearance within 24 hours. Arraignment, initial appearance. Here, however, is the fly in the ointment. Isn't that just a gross image? Baltimore and Maryland do not have the means of fulfilling their constitutional obligations. The police arrested hundreds of people on Monday, it's Wednesday now, by this morning, 235 of them had still not been formally charged with any sort of crime. They were just swept up off of the streets and disappeared. Over at BuzzFeed, they interviewed Katie Dadamo. She's with the Office of the Public Defender there. And she said hundreds of human beings were being held in tiny cells at central booking and intake. They have not been able to shower. That 34 juveniles swept up by police are being held in separate facilities across the street. And juveniles are an even more complicated issue. You do not incarcerate a juvenile offender unless, if there is, at least in most states, this is the way it works, you do not incarcerate a juvenile if there is any less restrictive alternative. And the less restrictive alternative is viewed with regard to the best interests of the child. So somewhere in Baltimore City, someone has made the determination that it is in the best interest of 34 children to be disappeared and warehoused in a juvenile detention facility on charges, It ain't murder, rape, mayhem, arson, who knows? The city courts and the state's attorney's office, and isn't this ironic, were closed on Tuesday as a result of the unrest. So, because of the unrest, the judicial system, the constitutionally mandated judicial system of Maryland, collapsed. Rochelle Ritchie is director of communications at the state's attorney's office and says, well, some people were formally charged in court. Some people does not apparently include 235 human beings. This is how civil, not riots, not peaceful protests on the street, this is how civil order breaks down. It got so bad that Maryland Public Defender Services reached out to private practicing lawyers for help, just trying to provide bare minimum representation to people charged with various forms of crimes. You look cross-eyed at a cop, you get charged with resisting. Paul DeWolf told the Daily Record, we're seeking volunteer attorneys from the private bar, and they'll pay up to $50 an hour to private attorneys to do it. Isn't just sweeping people off the street and detaining them with no access to due process, isn't that what we expect of what we used to call the third world? Isn't that what we used to refer to as, fascism? They shut constitutional courts down because people were upset about the murder of a young black man. That is a system that is teetering on the brink of, and look, it appears to have collapsed. This is what we mean. Me and that mouse in my pocket. When I say, this is a crumbling empire. So that's 230-some-odd people who are just in judicial limbo. Hell, they might be innocent. Not just not guilty, but straight up innocent. Granted, there's no finding of innocence in an American judicial system, but they might be innocent. And they might be sitting in a holding cell somewhere on the whim of some pissed off cop. One of those moments when you wish the UN kind of had some teeth, because those are what we like to call human rights violations. That's the kind of shit that if maybe you were reading it on, you were sitting out on the plaza somewhere in, say, Buenos Aires, and you were reading it, you'd go, oh, this does not, no, we've been to this movie, it does not end well. Yeah? So what I was talking about, by way of what I had not mentioned that I had been aware of since around April the 8th, is that as of April the 8th, and like I said, I've had no follow-up. A number of progressive media outlets had the story. Common Dreams, Sarah Lazar, a staff writer there, covered it. Brewing human rights crisis in Baltimore as city threatens mass water shutoffs. Are you aware of this? Have you heard about it on some other progressive radio program? And I was just behind the curve. Oh, I had no idea, Devin. Devin letting me know that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is best buddies with American Water Corporation. You know, the folks who brought us Fit to Use down in Charleston. Okay, Devin's aware of the story. Sarah Lazar wrote back at the beginning of the month, in what residents warn is a mounting human rights crisis, the city of Baltimore has commenced sending 25,000 notices, the vast majority to city and county residents, threatening to shut off water if delinquent bills are not paid within 10 days. The organization Food and Water Watch estimates that 75,000 residents are under immediate threat of having their taps turned off in a city beset with rising water rates and housing costs, where nearly one out of four people live below the federal poverty line. Now, that was April 8th. I have not seen follow-up. I don't know if the notices went out. It says Baltimore has commenced sending 25,000 notices. This happens at the same time within a couple of weeks of the murder. And I don't have any compunction against using that word. I've seen the damn video. I'm going to believe my eyes. They murdered Freddie Gray. By the way, I am told that, I've read that the report on the Baltimore Six, the six cops who rioted on Freddie Gray, let's think about how we frame issues. That was a six-man cop riot. And cop riots are almost always deadly. Within a couple of weeks of these notices being sent out, Freddie Gray would be dead. And don't think for a minute that a whole bunch of those 25,000 notices didn't go directly into the poverty-laden, poverty-constrained, poverty-choked community that is presently engaged in unrest. Jessica Lewis is the co-founder of Right to Housing Alliance, a human rights organization led by people most affected by the affordable housing crisis in Baltimore. When she was interviewed by Common Dreams, she said that a lot of renters we work with are angry but also tired because they see more and more of the costs of having a place to live getting further out of reach. This is part of a continuing trend towards the commodification of our basic needs. I kind of wish she could have used a phrase besides the commodification of our basic needs. Maybe we need a little bit plainer, stronger language or something like that. This is another part of the trend toward twisting the screws a little more tightly on poor people, because the 0.1% in this country, the 1% in this country, have yet to figure out that they don't haul U-Hauls behind hearses. That you don't get to take it with you. Oh, but I can give it to my heirs and assigns forever. Eliminate the estate tax! Stop the oppression of the wealthy! Get the jackbooted heel of the government off our poor little wealthy necks. In the past three years, water rates for ordinary ratepayers have gone up 40%. This is not because it has become harder to deliver water. This is not because Baltimore residents have seen a vastly improved water delivery system installed in their neighborhoods. This is because money. This is because capitalism. This is because there has been a decision in this country that access to clean drinking water should be a part of the day-to-day capitalist ingathering of wealth. And yeah, Devin's absolutely correct. Not one of those 25,000 notices I mentioned, not one of them went to a corporation whose water bill was overdue. Not one. Of course, that's the same MO as we had in Detroit. Far more money was owed to the water company there than were owed by little householders out in the burbs or in the city. Far more was owed by corporate customers, but corporate customers are treated with delicacy because they are, after all, people. Corporations are persons too now, my friend. Yeah. Not one went to a corporation. So I think it is at least instructive to note that something like the unrest in Baltimore doesn't simply happen in a vacuum. That people don't boil out into the streets until the screws have been twisted to a certain part, a certain portion, a level of intolerability. Let's see. How does that document begin? Juan Nata Prilly? No, that's not it. Wait a minute. I think we have some well-heeled, wealthy white folks who addressed this issue once upon a time. Yeah. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth to say, yeah. Well, that's only if England's being mean to you. That's not if the water system has cut off something as basic as water. Harry providing a little background on this. You may have heard the news that the Baltimore Department of Public Works plans to begin shutting off water service for unpaid bills. We're very concerned about the impact this could have on responsible tenants who have landlords who fail to pay water bills. Water bills are always in the landlord's name, giving a tenant little recourse if the water gets shut off. The city has other alternatives to collect. It can offer payment plans and subsidies to low-income homeowners, but for irresponsible, negligent landlords, it can and should force a change of ownership through a tax sale foreclosure that transfers the property to a non-profit, community-controlled organization. Oh, look, deadbeat wealthy people. How you like that? Scratch a crisis, find some money starting it. Ron and Raleigh with a note. Subject line, damn it! Now they want the hammock too. I can't see an end to it. The more I look at it, the more I believe that it's got to fail completely. We may be past got to. I think we may be at gonna. Yeah.
Yeah, but by golly, I tell you, that woman hitting her son in the head, she was showing him some tough love now, wasn't she? Boy, I tell you what, she's the mother of the year. That's what them young black men needs is more mamas a-whomping them on the head, maybe giving them some head injuries. That's some America. Wolverines upside the head.
Yeah, Devin says, I'll believe that corporations are people when Baltimore dehydrates one. Kind of explains why the disappeared aren't getting showers, though, doesn't it? One more disturbing tale coming from Baltimore. This is one of the disappeared protesters. Just one. And this isn't somebody who was throwing a brick. Don't you love the stories of people throwing cinder blocks? Picked up a cinder block lately? I mean, I got a hale, hearty 19-year-old son, and most he can do is lob a cinder block. Throwing cinder blocks? Really? Sounds like the Highland Games or something. You know, they throw logs and shit there. Throwing cinder blocks. Kind of heavy, aren't they? No, this is a disturbing story, and it's all the more disturbing because, yeah, I know, it's happening in America, the land of the free. The greatest country in the world on earth now, today, ever. That phrase keeps getting longer. So, one young man was actually seen on video trying to prevent violence. He has a name. He's recognized. He is Joseph Kent. He is 21 years old. He is a college student. He is a civil rights activist. And as the curfew descended last night, about 10 p.m., he was talking to the crowd and he was saying, disperse, disperse, go home, disperse, get away. There's video of this because Chicken Noodle News actually accidentally did something right. I guess they needed to fill some time for Aaron Burnett to figure out who to call a thug next. Maybe they were lining up Wolf Blitzer's next So Poor, So Black interview. But at any rate, Joseph Kent was trying to get the crowd to disperse, doing the right thing, when all of a sudden a National Guard armored car came whizzing up, and some nearby police officers shoved him behind the Humvee, and the Humvee then drove away. And Joseph Kent was no longer standing anywhere. CNN's Chris Cuomo said they ran out and grabbed him and then arrested him. The Baltimore police could not, at the time of the publication of the article, be reached for comment on his arrest. He was, according to a lawyer, apparently booked into jail. Interesting word, that, apparently. But the lawyer also said that he would not be among those who would be presented for bail on Wednesday. It is being referred to as a black bag kidnapping. Oh, I tell you what, much more of this, and I'm going to have to cue me up some Lee Greenwood. Maybe some Toby Keith talking about putting a boot in somebody's ass. Joseph Kent, by the way, had his hands up. This might be an appropriate time to remind people, not that y'all need much in the way of reminding, that you don't have to have nifty black uniforms and go goose-stepping across Europe in order to be deemed a fascist. I can never remember who said it, but it was so true. Surprised we didn't work it into the conversation with Frank Schaefer. It was said back in, what, the 30s, the 40s, maybe the early 50s? When fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in a flag and carrying the cross. Damn straight. And that was a, you know, that was a futuristic statement. Now I think we can just use the present tense. Fascism has come to America, and it is wrapped in the flag and carrying a cross. Let's go up and check in with Robert in or near Morgantown. Hey, Robert.
Good evening, Bob.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm just biding my time, trying to enjoy May and June, because I know what's going to happen come the end of June.
What happens the end of June? And by the way, can you get a little closer to your mic?
Sir. With the Supreme Court decision.
Oh, yeah, you mean on marriage?
Yeah, the gay marriage issue, yeah. I believe it's just basically hell's going to break loose.
In which direction?
Well, let's face it, if the Supreme Court rules that it should be allowed, same-sex marriage should be allowed in all 50 states, the religious right is going to go into a real hissy. But now they're already preparing for it. I see on Sunday morning's show that Tony Perkins,
yeah,
is already preparing people, trying to say, well, if the Supreme Court does that, we're just going to ignore the Supreme Court.
How are they going to ignore the Supreme Court? Are they going to start? Are they going to have some sort of gay marriage Kristallnacht?
Who knows with this bunch?
I mean, that wasn't a joke, Robert. I mean, I don't know what it means they're going to ignore it. Is he saying that the states will ignore it? That the states will engage in nullification? Because then, if the states really do that, then it's on.
Some of them are. Yeah, some of them are already talking about that we may need to get our, representatives and senators to make a constitutional amendment. Now, believe it, to override the Supreme Court decision.
And so they're gonna pass a law in Congress. Hell, they couldn't pass a defense of marriage amendment in Congress.
Well, I don't know, maybe they're going to reform the troops, regroup the troops, tell every Republican there, we're going to bring this up, and if you don't vote for it, why, you're going to get primaried next spring, and we'll put our Tea Party, extreme right-wing, Bible-thumping flag waving Tea Party person in your place. You know, I think the Republican Party may be just about to go on the ropes because they're being taken over by this extreme right wing side.
Well, but see, that goes back to my question toward the end of the conversation with Frank Schaefer. Are they on the way out? I mean, if it turns out that gay people can have marriage equality, does that mean that the right-wing evangelical religion industry is going to dry up and blow away and go home? You heard his answer, didn't you?
I was listening, but I'm not sure if I
he said no. It is. He said no. It is a self-sustaining industry now. Tax-free, you know.
Well, certainly, because religion is that way. You can have you ever tried to talk sense to someone who is a devoutly religious person? You can't do it. It's impossible. I have an 80-year-old aunt. We disagree about this stuff all the time about it.
And she will not. And right. Well, that's because you're asking her to see reason. That ain't going to happen.
Oh, no. Well, that's, don't you think that that's what it is with most of them? The only thing you can do is hope that they don't pass it on so much to their children and grandchildren, but it's beginning to look like that's not working.
We've been hoping that for a long daggum time, Robert.
Yeah, we've been hoping that about the black relationship for about 150 years. Still hasn't worked, has it?
No, well, that's because, and that's because we have never had anything approaching a legitimate, realistic conversation.
No, there's probably not.
There's never the vast majority of white America does not want to acknowledge that it's even a problem. You know, despite the brilliant words of any number of great thinkers about the fact that, you know, even though you didn't directly participate in it, you benefit from it. You know, no.
Yeah.
I mean, look, they haven't started pulling down the statues which were put up on, you know, the statues to Confederate soldiers that are on every courthouse lawn across in every county across the South. They haven't started pulling those down. And by the way, let's remember those things were only put up. They weren't put up immediately after the war. They were put up as Reconstruction was being fought. And it was a tacit warning to everybody of color that, by God, you're being watched. Can you imagine being a person of color and having to walk into in 2015, can you imagine being a person of color having to walk into a Southern courthouse and having that and having that hateful old Confederate traitor staring down at you?
Mm-hmm.
We talk a lot about the Confederate flag, but we don't talk about those damn statues. I mean, Jesus, that's like if every municipal building or every judicial building in Germany had a statue of a stormtrooper standing in front of it. It is the same thing.
Well,
sorry, I wasn't trying to pontificate there.
No, that's okay. It's okay. I understand. Yeah, whatever you have that harkens back and brings back the memories of how things were in those days, that's absolutely, whether it's a statue of Stonewall Jackson or Robert E. Lee or a Confederate flag. I've seen in the last few days where I guess California is trying to ban the Confederate flag. Good luck with that one.
Well, they're trying to ban it relative to California government. They cannot outright ban it because you've got to have a First Amendment right to revere traitors and treason.
But it goes to what I heard a while back, and that is, you know, the start of all this is trouble is when you think that someone else is less than you are, or that you're better than someone else. And I see that goes not just to the color of your skin, but your religious beliefs too, I believe. And, you know, whether it's a Christian looking down upon a Muslim, or whether it's a white person looking down upon a black person, or a person from another country. My God, remember, there was a time not so long ago when they didn't even want the Irish in this country. You know, people who were white.
And Irish, Italians, Eastern Europeans. Everybody's had their their moment of being disrespected in this country. But there has never been a moment, even during those times, there has never been a moment when that same disrespect was not afforded, pressed down, and shaken together to the black community. Never.
Well, I heard a very disturbing comment the other day that was, given, was supposed to have been said by Sarah Palin, but I don't know. I've tried to find out whether she said it or not. And that was, she said toward the Baltimore riots that those people, you know, basically they should straighten and behave themselves. After all, we let them come into this country or something like that. Well, you know, most of the black people in this country, I believe, are descendants of slaves, and we didn't let those people come in. We drug those people into this country.
Absolutely.
Brought them over in chains, huh?
Yeah, we kidnapped.
Yeah. And the saddest thing about that was, my understanding was, our black slaves, a lot of them were sold into slavery by their black brothers in Africa.
The Portuguese and the Dutch are at work over there.
Well,
and you've got
they're probably
and they, and they and they provided the capital impetus for doing that. I mean, it's not a lot different than when we started our war in Afghanistan and the United States started throwing little packets of $5,000 all over the place saying, hey, you got anybody here that's a little suspect that might be a little Taliban-y? And so, you know, you got a guy up the holler. They got hollers in Afghanistan. And he's got a neighbor who's got some nice bottom land, and he'd kind of like to have it. So he goes and talks to the lieutenant and says, oh, him over there? Oh, yeah, he's got all kinds of Taliban stuff. Next thing you know, he's got 5,000 bucks in his pocket. The guy's on a plane to Guantanamo Bay with a diaper on. And, hey, look, bottom land. I think I'll plant it this spring.
Well, people's injustice to each other, it's just a hard thing to knock it out. It's always been there, and it's beginning to look like it's always going to be there. It's just, you know. And to go back to the Supreme Court for just a moment, I only see that there's possibly three things they can do, and two of them are going to make the religious right very angry. Number one would be if they said, yes, gay marriage, there's, you know, if you have let a man marry a man, you have to, or let a man marry a woman, you also have to let him marry a man. That is sexual discrimination. And I believe that.
That clip I ran earlier, they're already trying to recharacterize it that if two guys or two women can get married, that somehow somehow heterosexual bigots are being denied their rights. Oh, they've got their fallback trenches dug, and they know exactly when to go back into them.
Now, another thing I suppose they could do would be just end government recognition of marriage, period. Just say, look, marriage is just a religious church thing.
No, you can't do that. You can't do that.
Why can't you?
Because the whole reason for marriage equality, in many instances, has absolutely nothing to do with romance or church. It has to do with the fact that rights and duties are accorded, or rights in particular, are accorded to married people under the Constitution of the United States as it operates to control the lawmaking process. And so if you just said, in point of fact, marriage, that's one of the fundamental lies the right wing tells, that this is somehow tied up in religion. Up to like the 1500s, the Catholic Church would not allow, if I read this stuff correctly, would not allow a wedding to take place inside a church because a wedding was entirely too profane. Being all it was tied up in sex and everything.
Well, when you go to the core of it, then what we have to decide is whether marriage is it something religious or is it something secular?
It is, because this country is entirely secular. Being married in a church does not confer marriage. Marriage is conferred by signature to a document that is filed in a governmental office at the county level. I mean,
well, I can understand that.
Married couples, for instance, still to this day in West Virginia, you got to go get a blood test. Make sure you're not marrying Cousin May Eller.
make sure that the two of you don't have have the clap or anything like that. You have to have a blood test before you can get married. I remember, because it was about this time 22 years ago, I was pissed off at having to have a blood test.
Well, my understanding is that's for, like, the Rh factor, because you can have, if there's a blood transfer between the mother and the child.
Yeah, but see, the state really has no business in that. That part the state has no business in, because there is no guarantee that a marriage is going to lead to children, no matter how many right-wingers holler about it. But yea, verily, guess what? That little tidbit was included as a result of right-wingery all those eons ago. And I would not be a damn bit surprised to find out that just like right to work, blood tests in marriage originated in the damn South to make sure that nobody was going to be miscegenating.
Yeah. And, of course, we get back to the factor here that if you want to get married, there's nothing to keep you from getting your license and being married by a justice of the peace, right? You don't have to have a preacher.
No, you absolutely do not. And there is nothing in allowing marriage equality by the Supreme Court that says that the Southern Baptist Church is ever going to have to marry Adam and Steve.
Yeah.
Because in point of fact, by saying that that gay people cannot get married, that actually tramples on the First Amendment freedom of religion rights of churches that do recognize same-sex marriage. That knife cuts both ways.
Yes, it would. That absolutely would.
Oh, I'm glad to know. Gerald just informed me. He said, I think they did away with the blood test a few years ago. Not sure. Not 100% sure. I hope they did.
I'm not sure West Virginia has it, but now, last time I checked, Maryland still did. Some states still do, I'm pretty sure.
Well, I hate to say it, but I got to get out of here, Robert. It's been a lovely conversation. Thank you
very
kindly.
All right. Well, we'll continue this some other time.
We certainly will.
Have a good night, Bob.
All right. You too, Robert. Bye now. That's Robert calling from somewhere near the Morgantown area. And it is time to get out of here, so that means it's time for some thanks to be in order. I want to thank Ed for jumping in alongside Will, who was first to jump in with fundraising this evening. And I also want to thank Robert. Different Robert. For being part of the fundraising this evening. So with all of that, we find ourselves having raised $100 this evening and only $50 to go to finish the evening's fundraising goal. Thank you. Thank all three of you very kindly, and I hope maybe some other folks will jump in as well. I hope you enjoyed the program this evening. I hope it was a worthy expenditure of your precious finite time upon this planet. I try always to make sure that it is. Join us tomorrow evening for Thorn in the Front Porch Thursday, seeing as how there won't be a Friday on the front porch, because, in fact, Friday is anniversary day. And like I said, Agnes and I are going to, I don't know, make up a couple of bologna sandwiches and go a hand-holding and take a walk somewhere. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff who makes all of this happen. Thank you to our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky, Man Cave. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. None of this program doesn't happen without all these people. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT, ACHEACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.